morning. We'd like to welcome everyone here this morning. Get the doors for me. Thank you. By way of housekeeping, between 10:45 and 11 a.m., there will be a question of consideration. So it looks like we'll have one 15-minute vote. After this vote, we will then move approximately 1 hour of a debate on the rule on the Federal Election Integrity Act of 2006. That will occur approximately between 12:15 and 12:45 would be the second series of votes. Just to let everyone know. I'd like to welcome the new commanders here. You're beginning a year of well-earned opportunity after many years of faithfully serving the veterans within your organization. I look forward to a constructive and positive year ahead. Last November, after meeting with your organizations at Carlisle Barracks, just north of Gettysburg Battlefield, I announced a decision to enhance the way the committee developed its budget views and estimates. This decision was to reform the way we gather the views of veteran service organizations and military service organizations. Your members have a great store of invaluable insights that deserve even greater consideration. As a subcommittee chairman, I saw myself how the process of hearings held after we had submitted our views and estimates for the VA to the Budget Committee had effectively, for years, had silenced your voice by positioning the testimony of VSOs and MSOs after the fact. The status quo, I didn't believe, was working for veterans because it made you a critic after the fact. So we changed that process. Last February, before we developed the FY 2007 views and estimates, the committee heard from 19 VSOs and MSOs, some of whom had not heard, that we'd not heard from before. And it was powerful. It represented a significant increase in access to this committee at a key point in the budget cycle. When I discussed accelerating these budget and legislative hearings into February, I also said that we wanted to meet again in September to review the fiscal year just ending and to look forward to the next year. The timing of a September hearing is auspicious because the administration is now beginning to develop its next year budget request. I compliment the former American Legion National Commander, Tom Bach, because he championed to me the Legion's approach. And that was that the American Legion felt that they had separated themselves from other veterans groups by presenting their information to the committee in the fall as the administration was developing its request. That approach made a lot of sense, and we've adapted and augmented it. In the Armed Services Committee, they received the testimony from the chairman and the joint chiefs in the spring prior to budget views and estimates, and then we bring back the chairman and the joint chiefs in the fall for a look back, look ahead. And I think adapting that same process will be very important. As we look at the budget cycle, you can see that we've opened up this access to the congressional and administration's budget process at uniquely responsive points in the cycle. So what we have today is the opening of the fiscal year 2008 budget process. This is a war budget. The country is at war and faces severe demands on its fiscal resources. Yet this is also a budget cycle that reflects a decade of unprecedented growth and support for veterans. The VA budget has nearly doubled in 10 years. Reflecting that support, VA has earned a reputation for high-quality health care. I can also recall when I first arrived here in Congress in 1993 and 94, there were flatline budgets in the VA. And I can also recall some horrific cases where appropriators took money out of the VA to fund other domestic programs. We've not seen that in the last 12 years. A doubled budget, a nearly doubled budget, and quality product do not, however, mean there are not significant challenges. The VA secretary, before this committee, took ownership of the budgetary process that we exposed had flaws in the inputs within the modeling. It was reflected in his strong FY07 funding. Yet a perennial challenge to us is the ghost population that moves in and out of the VA healthcare system, sometimes using the VA, sometimes opting for TRICARE, or sometimes using their HMO. They move in and out of the systems. Simply plugging a few numbers into a capitation spreadsheet does not address this type of complexity. Discretionary funding gives us the responsiveness to do correctly that which is hard, that which is difficult, but must be done right. Comparatively, a, quote, unassured or mandatory health care funding model, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would cost nearly $500 billion over 10 years. $500 billion. That would be a costly experiment. In contrast, the strong discretionary budgets of the past decade, which have also proven responsive to change, are anything With strong funding, we should expect good programs, yet the seamless transition of service members entering the VA system is still not where it should be. Last month, Secretary Nicholson, Chairman Bozeman, Mr. Salazar, and I went to Kuwait, Iraq, and Germany to assess the continuum of health care from the medical, from the medic or Navy corpsman all the way to a level 4 medical facility. We were impressed by the quality of care and the total integration and teamwork within the armed services. Yet between DOD and VA, we still have a gap. Wounded GIs arriving at Longstuhl Medical Center minutes after we arrived had paper medical records on their chests. Largely because of the Pentagon's foot dragging, the VA and DOD still do not have a truly interoperable system of electronic medical records. This is not seamless, and we can do better. The recent theft of personal data belonging to millions of veterans has shown the utter necessity that VA and every government agency with sensitive data must have centralized management over information technology, information policy, and information security. IT is the organization's central nervous system. I appreciate the work of Mr. Filner and all members of this committee in the many hearings that we held exposing part of the problems, but we've also moved toward a solution, and I want to thank the bipartisan work this committee had done. I appreciate those of you who worked also with us on this issue, and I'm also disappointed with those who said that it was too hard and it was outside of their lane, because we all have to accept in this one. With regard to your organizations, if you are outraged by the lapses in security and unnecessary risks to your members and our veterans, then join with me in dislodging the status quo and doing the right thing for our veterans. Many of you cited the disability claims backlog and also in your written testimony. This issue is the elephant in the room. The total backlog exceeds 800,000 and is climbing. I compliment the task force on accountability that I've formed. I'll be meeting with them here within the next 10 days. Some of your organizations are members of this task force. I formed this task force to examine issues across the VA, not just VBA, that can improve the claims development process. Timely and accurate claims decisions are as important to America's veterans as the delivery of a high-quality care. Some, though, think that if we bring lawyers into the process, that it will solve the problem. I'm apprehensive, but I want to be a good listener, and I want to hear from all of you on that issue, because the Senate has passed the measure and have given it a top priority for us as we negotiate these bills here. And so Mr. Filner and I and members of the committee need to hear your views. So ladies and gentlemen, these issues are not going away. They are at the heart. And my top three priorities as chairman right now are, number one, caring for veterans who have the service-connected disabilities, those with special needs, and the indigent. Two, ensuring a seamless transition from military service to the VA. It's a very encompassing issue. And I agree with the VFW's testimony. It's a lot more than just computer systems. And providing veterans, and third, providing veterans every opportunity to live full and healthy lives. These are my top priorities, and I look forward to hearing from yours. Before we begin, on behalf of the committee's members and staff, I extend appreciation for the enduring contributions made by your membership, your auxiliaries, and your families. You make a great difference in the tone and tenor of our own country. We are at war in two theaters and still have responsibilities globally. Our men and women in uniform are performing their duty magnificently. They are coming home with the simple expectation that we will be there for them. It's up to all of us to help these returning service members transition back into civilian life. The VA has its structure, but personal contact, which is your strength, plays a tremendous role. When you put your arm around the young Lance Corporal just back from name the province, name the country, you are also at the tip of the spear, and you can also help them in many ways. The intangible is also equally as important as the intangible is equally as important as the tangible. So I want to thank you. I now recognize Mr. Evans, if he has an opening statement, we submit it into the record, and I now recognize the acting ranking member, Mr. Filner, for his statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I ask unanimous consent to put my full statement in the record.
No objection.
I do associate myself with your comments on this committee's work and hopefully the Congress's work on security, cybersecurity in the VA. We had millions of veterans worried, scared about what would happen, and I think we came out with a much better policy at the end, and I hope the House and the Senate will act on it. I cannot associate myself with the remarks on the process that we had and the role of the VSOs in that process. I'm glad you're here today. Better late than never. The chairman said the timing is auspicious that you're here. Well, it's auspicious because all your members are not here with you, which during the joint hearings that we had for many, many years, people felt a part of the process, and your membership is now not part of the process. We are also at a very inauspicious time. We haven't passed this year's budget, or the coming fiscal year's budget yet, as a nation. And so to hear your views on next year, nobody is in their head is not in that process at all. And the enhancement that you would bring here is being involved at the beginning, middle, and the end of the process, not at some strange time where members are not here. And we ought to have a chance for your membership to see this committee in action. That's what democracy is all about. That's what we should go for, and we should work with you in the coming years to make those scheduling things where you have an impact and have your members here with you. What troubles me right now about our process, aside from the way you were excluded from it, is that you have to trudge up here at any time of the year, hand in hand, begging for money. I'm sure I'm not the only one who finds that this is not just ironic, but shameful. It is long past time to place all veterans funding where it belongs, in the mandatory category, so that each year the Department of Veterans Affairs knows how much it will have and can forecast and plan better. More important, veterans of all generations can have greater assurance that their health care will be there when they need it. The chairman called our time now in the war budget. Yes, we are at war. And taking care of our veterans is part of the cost of war and should be included in any war budget. We have a bill that was written by Lane Evans, of which many of us are proud co-sponsors. The budget would increase to meet inflation, respond to enrollment numbers. And those numbers should include all eligible veterans. We must bring back into the VA healthcare fold those veterans whom this administration is now barring, and there's more than 250,000 so far, many of whom are combat decorated, who have health problems deemed unrelated to their service, and who might be unable to afford private health care. They, too, deserve to use the system established for veterans and shouldn't be excluded simply because they make a modest or even higher income. When they took the oath, we didn't ask how much money they made. Their good health shouldn't be incumbent upon some arbitrary income level now. Congress intended that this to be a temporary management tool for the Secretary for a single budget cycle, not to be perpetual, as this administration seems to intend. And the assurances that come with mandatory funding would be in stark contrast to the embarrassing charade we call a budget process today, and to the current system of care under which This administration is not dropping its effort to make veterans pay more for their care rather than asking for needed resources. It makes thousands wait longer than they should have for clinical appointments. It's failing to appropriately address the mental health requirements of service members returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as past generations of veterans. It's thumbing its nose at the statutory requirements of long-term care and the needs of our older veterans. And the administration sought cuts in traumatic brain injury care at the height of a war that is producing more brain-injured veterans than ever before. And we are failing to commit adequate staff and resources to the counseling programs. All this, as I said previously, as it has turned away a quarter of a million veterans who wanted to enroll. The supplemental request last year illustrated just how flawed the process is. VA had to request around $3 billion more to cover expenses, not in the 05 and 06 budgets that we passed. The secretary told us at this hearing room that the reason they messed up is because their formulas did not take into account that we had a war going on. The independent budget, which many of you are involved in, knew exactly what the figure ought to be, knew what the administration should have given and what the Congress failed to make up for it. So, and today we have the VA rightfully touted in many ways for the exceptional quality of its clinical care and its use of technology. It has come a long way from some of the stereotype images of the 60s or 70s of lots of patients waiting in dirty wards, receiving substandard care from uncaring providers. It is now on the cutting edge of health care in this country and in the world, and that is very commendable. But that system should not have delayed care, rationing of care, or any problems with access or quality, because we do have the resources as a nation to adequately fund those who have borne the battle and have given us our freedom. I'm pleased that virtually all the organizations here today support the passage of mandatory funding for veterans health care, and I can assure you that we will continue to press for this in the next Congress. Let me just say one word on the so-called core veteran issue. I don't know if that emerged in this ghost population that Mr. Bhuiya referred to, but some have claimed that there are two classes of veterans, those that are core veterans and others. Sure, there's veterans that have a greater need for VA services and should have a higher priority. We will always keep that in mind and fight for that. But all veterans should have access to VA health care. A veteran who scaled the cliffs of Normandy, or who walked Point in the jungles of Vietnam, or who endured the frozen reservoirs of Korea, or served in the Persian Gulf, and was fortunate enough not to be wounded or disabled, is just as much a veteran as any other veteran, even if his health care needs are not based on that service and no matter what that income is. That veteran deserves access to our health care system. And we certainly on this side will fight for that. There are a lot of other issues that you are going to talk about today. I have referred to them in my longer statement that is part of the record. Let me just make one last comment. We have an administration that says support our troops and support our troops, and we all do. Supporting of troops means to support them when they come home also. Right now, in my medical center in San Diego, we have almost 1,000 veterans on a waiting list. If you come home from Iraq and Afghanistan, you may wait a year for a dentist or some other specialty treatment. If you have PTSD, you may have not recognized it. DOD may not have recognized it, VA hasn't recognized it, the family hasn't recognized it, and we're going through the same process of having those mental scars that are not treated as we did with Vietnam. We have veterans coming back with PTSD, their families not understanding it, family violence, domestic quarrels, drinking, alcohol and drug abuse, loss of job, homelessness, suicides. Hundreds of suicides of those coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Spoke a year too early. That's a tragedy. We should never have allowed the Vietnam vets not to be properly cared for, and we still have a chance to rectify that mistake, no matter how long ago it was. And we're repeating the same error today. Our budget is $80 billion for the VA. Our national budget is $3 trillion. Our debt is $8 trillion. We have enough money in this country to care for all of those who have returned from battle, whether it's from Iraq, Afghanistan, or World War II. Let's do the job right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Statement may be submitted for the record. Today we will hear from several commanders, presidents, and representatives of veteran service organizations. First, representing the veterans of foreign wars, the United States, is the Commander-in-Chief, Gary Kirpas. Did I get it right, Commander?
Yes. Thank you.
Commander Kirpas was elected in August 31, 2006, at the VFW's 107th National Convention. He is the first member to be elected to this office from the state of Alaska. Commander Kirpas served the United States Army from 1967 to 1969. In Vietnam, he served with the 541st Transportation Company, providing convoy security throughout the Central Highlands. He was awarded the National Defense Service Medal, the Vietnam Service Medal, with four Bronze Stars, and the Republic of Vietnam Service Medal. In 1970, Commander Kirpas joined the VFW post, 1539, in Babbitt, Minnesota, where he became a life member in 1976. He earned the title of All-American Post Commander in 1977, and in 1983 was named All-American District Commander. Commander Kirpas transferred to VFW Post 9785 in Eagle River, Alaska in 1985, and is currently a life member of the VFW Post 9365. Congratulations on this appointment.
Thank you.
Representing AMVETS, the National Commander, Tom McGriff. Commander McGriff was elected National Commander of AMVETS on August 20, 2006 at the organization's 62nd National Convention in Reno, Nevada. He joined the United States Navy in 1959 and was assigned to the USS, I'm not going to get this right, Tyru. What is Tyru?
Tyru is an extinct fish that swam the ocean.
Is what?
It's an extinct fish.
An extinct fish? but it tastes really good. All right, Dr. Snyder. All right, I'll go with the doctor's opinion. Wow, and this was a submarine.
Yes, sir.
And it didn't bother any of you that you were on an extinct fish.
All submarines at that period of time were named after fish.
Yeah, but not after extinct.
Yeah, but what about extinct ones? Were you the only one that had that distinction?
No, there were several.
Wow. Well, this was a World War II diesel electronic submarine based in Pearl Harbor.
Also extinct.
We don't have all those diesels anymore. He patrolled the coast of the Philippines, Hong Kong, and Japan, receiving the Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal for his role in skirmishes in the disputed islands in the Taiwan Strait. Commander McGriff was subsequently assigned to the USS Ethan Allen, the nation's first-in-class Polaris submarine, which was armed with 16 nuclear missiles. He's a life member of Post 76. He has held many leadership positions at national, state, and local levels of AMVETS. He joined AMVETS in 1991 after spending more than 30 years with the United States Navy. Congratulations. Speaking for the disabled American veterans is the new national commander, Bradley S. Barton. Commander Barton, a native of Indiana, enlisted in the United States Marine Corps in 1966. In 1968, while serving as a member of the 3rd Battalion, 26th Army Regiment at the Battle of Khe Sanh during the Vietnam War, he was severely wounded when shrapnel from an enemy mortar severed his spinal cord. As a result of his wounds, he was medically separated from the Marine Corps in August 1968. Following his retirement, Commander Barton earned his BS degree from Indiana University in 1973 and his law degree from Indiana University in 1982. Commander Barton has also been very active in the DAV since joining the Indianapolis Chapter 3 in 1975. He's a recipient of the DAV's Department of Indiana Meritorious Occupation Achievement Award in 1979 and was named by Indiana Governor's Handicapped Hoosier of the Year for 1979. He's also a member of several other veterans organizations. Commander Barton is currently membership chairman of the DAV Chapter 1 in Portland, Oregon, where he and his wife live. Testifying on behalf of National Commander of the Blind Veterans of America, Larry Bloat, is Dr. Thomas Zampieri. Doctor served with the active duty as a medic in the United States Army in 1972-1975. Upon completing physician assistant training. He served from September 1978 to August 2000 as an Army National Guard physician assistant, retiring as major. During this time, he was involved in several military training programs and schools. He is currently employed as the National Director of Government Relations at BVA. He was awarded his PhD in political science from La Crosse University earlier this year. Congratulations. Representing the Non-Commissioned Officers Association of the United States of America is Sergeant Gene Overstreet, NCOA's president. Sergeant Major Overstreet entered the Marine Corps in June 1966. He served with the 3rd Marine Division in Vietnam. Sergeant Major Overstreet also served as the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego as a junior drill instructor, senior drill instructor, series gunnery sergeant, and chief instructor. Reassigned to drill instructor school, he was an instructor, drill master, and chief instructor. He was later selected as the 12th Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps in April 1991 and assumed the post on June 28, 1991. Sergeant Major Overstreet retired from the Marine Corps in June 1995. He joined NCOA as Vice President Membership Recruiting on May 1, 2001, and accepted the position as President August 22, 2003. We welcome to all of you. Before we begin, we'd like to, if all of you have written testimony, do all of you have the written testimony? All nod their head in the affirmative. That written testimony will be submitted. You submit that written testimony to the record. All acknowledge in the affirmative. Without objection, it will be received in the into the record, so ordered. On procedural rules, each of you will have 10 minutes to present your testimony. I'll give you great latitude to get that in, and but in fairness, recognize others also are seeking to testify here today. So when you see the light go off, just you'll know what to do and try to wrap up your statement. And then membership will serve under the 5-minute rule. The VFW commander, welcome, and you are recognized.
As this nation's largest organization of combat veterans, the Veterans of Foreign Wars of the U.S., is dedicated to helping one another, working as a team and doing what is right for all who have worn the uniform in the past, as well as for all who proudly wear it today. I have charged the VFW with a mission of putting veterans first. It's a mission you well understand. This Veterans Affairs Committee is the only congressional committee with a distinct constituency. You serve not the government or private business, but actual men and women who bravely serve this country, protecting everything that America stands for. It's an important mission. It's a sacred mission. It's one that must be taken seriously. Looking back over the last year, I see many good things, but there have also been some huge bumps in the road. First, let's look at the good. After the funding problems of the previous fiscal year, in which VA ran out of money due to poor budgetary modeling, the administration stepped forward and recommended a sufficient amount of money for veterans programs. Also, as your committee formulated the budget recommendations, we were pleased that you listened to what we had to say. You used our funding levels from the independent budget as part of your baseline. We didn't get everything that we wanted, but it was a very good step, and we appreciate the serious consideration you gave to our views and your demonstrated commitment in moving them forward. Despite the committee's and the administration's attention, VA still does not have a budget for a fiscal year that begins in a few days. This, unfortunately, is nothing out of the ordinary. It has been the better part of a decade since VA has had a budget on time. This is a major and continuous failure of Congress. Mr. Chairman, you rightly want VA to operate more like a business, using best practices to efficiently care for veterans in a cost-effective way. Yet, how is VA to operate that way when the managers can't properly plan for the coming year? No business, let alone one as large as the VA, can function without knowing their budget. Yet, year after year, Congress asks VA to do that. That's directly at odds with how all of us want the VA to operate. We have in the past called for changes to VA funding mechanisms. The discretionary process as currently implemented does not work the way it should. How can we accept that? If this Congress is going to fail to live up to its obligation to provide VA sufficient money on time, then we need to modify the current funding process. One of the highest priorities of the VFW is the health care and well-being of those men and women returning from conflicts overseas. While the battles are ongoing, the actual individuals fighting are constantly changing, and each day sees the creation of hundreds of new veterans. We have long argued that their care is part of the ongoing cost of war. The fulfillment of that cost, a national obligation, is what this committee is charged with overseeing. One of the VFW's greatest concerns is the mental health of these returning service members and the effects it can have on their families. VA claims that they are making substantial progress in this area, but it is something that needs to be continuously monitored, making sure that these men and women get the counseling and service they need to transition back into society and to lead productive lives has a big upfront cost. But it's something that, if left unchecked, will create many more problems down the road. Many of these problems, such as homelessness or mental illness, are things that no veteran should suffer from, especially because we can tackle it today. Another important area that deserves increased attention is care related to blast injuries. We must redouble our efforts in prosthetic research and servicing, and also on VA polytrauma centers. We also strongly believe that more research and time must be spent on traumatic brain injuries. We must learn more about these injuries and be mindful that some of these symptoms might not appear immediately. We must be attuned to any long-term physical or mental impairment that these blasts create. We must give these servicemen and women every tool they need to heal and become whole. That the VFW can come before this committee year after year after year, emphasizing the need for a seamless transition, is a disappointment. I am not sure that we can even point to signs of progress. What's being done? Where are the roadblocks? Mr. Chairman, we need you, using the oversight powers of this committee, to give us answers to these questions. We know that you share our frustration, and we urge you to make this a priority for the coming year. What we're asking for, though, isn't just the mere ability of VA computers being able to speak to DOD's computers. That's certainly an essential part. But it's more about giving these men and women a hand and a seamless transition back into a productive society with the skills and training they need to be the leaders of tomorrow. That's going to require emphasis on education and training for real-world jobs. At a hearing earlier this year, I am told that you offer to look into improving the benefits provided under the Montgomery GI Bill. But as of today, nothing has been passed into law. As we look ahead, it's important that we focus on the benefits being provided to our reservists, especially as they continue to carry a large share of the burden of fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. These men and women are fighting as active duty troops. We need to give them a benefit that recognizes their contributions by allowing them to take their MGIB benefits with them when they separate. In this regard, we applaud your introduction of H.R. 6096, the Disabled War Families Education Act of 2006. Another important area that's integral to a seamless transition is an effective vocational rehabilitation office. The influx in service-disabled veterans creates new challenges, especially when it comes to vocational rehabilitation and employment. A truly effective program will be focused on a goal of avoiding disability-related unemployability later in life, and that will allow the disabled veteran to build a career to provide for him or her as well as the veteran's family. We envision a program that will create skills that will help these heroes who have sacrificed body and mind to overcome these obstacles over a lifetime of employment, not just to launch them with a few years of jobs. Unfortunately, I must turn to an issue which has taken up much of this committee's time and which is of the utmost concern of our 2.4 million members. The recent failure of VA to adequately secure veteran-sensitive financial and medical data is disgraceful. To say that we are disappointed with the leadership of the VA is an understatement. It is especially distressing for our service members fighting overseas to know that they and their families may be financially harmed because of mishandling of sensitive personal data. The last thing they need to be worrying about on the battlefield is if their families are going to be okay and if their credit is going to be ruined by a bunch of thieves. This is why we are very disturbed by the withdrawal of the administration's offer to provide 1 year of credit monitoring services. It is outrageous that the government would err not on the side of caution with potentially 27 million veterans and family members at risk and a litany of data breaches coming to light. We of the VFW are most gratified with how seriously this committee has taken the problem and that your series of hearings have focused on getting to the root of the problem and providing permanent solutions. We would urge that you not relent in this most important effort. Looking forward, VA needs flexibility, the ability to adapt and change as technology transforms. This committee clearly needs to exercise rigorous oversight of VA to ensure that these sorts of disgraceful problems do not occur in the future. But oversight does not automatically mean micromanagement. As we look forward, another major challenge confronting VA for the coming year, as has been in the case for a number of years now, is the ineffective operation of the Veterans Benefits Administration. The claims backlog is a persistent problem, something my predecessors have highlighted every time they come before this committee. That I can still sit here, citing an ever-growing number of cases, highlights VA's inability to develop and implement a proper plan to tackle this problem. VFW witnesses have always stressed that VBA's problem is, at its core, a problem with the quality of their decisions. By their own measurement, the VBA commits serious errors on over 100,000 cases every year. These are not minor errors. They can affect the quality of the future lives of veterans and their families. VBA has no plan to address this problem, and we urge you to make it a focus of your oversight this year. Despite best efforts and intent, VA has been unable to manage its caseload, and the backlog swells daily. As the number of pending claims increase, the difficulties of managing the backlog and implementing solutions increases. VA tells us that it takes several years for a new employee to get up to speed with the adjudication process. There are many complexities and technicalities which make immediate mastery difficult. Speed and accuracy comes with practice, yet there is little continuity of funding within VBA. What's the goal to make VA better? What are the plans? It isn't just enough to throw money at these issues, a sentiment I'm sure you and this committee share. But the problem VA faces do, by and large, relate to funding. We are not asking you to throw money into a pit. Instead, we ask for VA to be run efficiently with proper oversight. That's not too much to ask. Above all, veterans must come first. Before I conclude, I'd like to discuss one related issue that's before your committee, the Veterans Choice of Representation Act. This bill would allow veterans to hire lawyers when first filing a disability compensation claim, something that they are prevented from doing now. At first blush, this sounds like a great idea, but it is something that the VFW is greatly concerned with. In fact, at our recent national convention, our membership voted in strong opposition to this proposal. Before embarking on the path which has brought me to this office, I served as a service officer in Alaska for over 20 years. It's a profoundly rewarding job, and one that I look back on with great fondness. There is a lot of satisfaction in helping a disabled comrade get treatment and compensation for his or her injuries. I fear that passage of this bill would dramatically change the non-adversary relationship for the worse. The system, while not perfect, is intended to serve veterans sympathetically and efficiently at this initial level. This law, we fear, would result in less timely service of claims and would provide program administrators with justification to ratchet back the service and assistance they provide, harming veterans who choose not to or cannot afford to spend money on a lawyer. The problem with the current system and the backlog is not because of the lack of legal representation, but because a lack of funding. The numbers we toss around for funding or caseloads aren't just numbers. They're real people. People who have worn the uniform of this great nation, their supervisors, their survivors, and their dependents. It's sometimes hard to keep this fact in mind. That's exactly why I've charged my organization with putting veterans first. Everything the VFW does and everything that the committee undertakes must be done with this in mind. I challenge the great men and women of the VFW to put veterans first, and I charge you with the same. For they are who we truly serve. and who we must put first in our hearts and priorities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. I will be happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That was our second bell. I will recess the committee, and we'll return after this one vote to take up testimony. Committee stands in recess for about 15 minutes.
Call this hearing back to order. I'm taking over the chair in the absence of the chairman, who had to go to Energy and Commerce to make a vote. He will be back sometime a little later. We appreciate your indulgence as we all had to go to a vote. See. Next up, AMVET's national commander, Mr. Tom McGriff, the man who spent many a day aboard a submarine named after an extinct fish. You are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Earlier this month, we paused to remember those who lost their lives on September the 11th. The attacks against the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the failed attempt in Pennsylvania began a new era in American history. Since that horrible day, this nation has been engaged in a different kind of war. When our troops return home with physical and psychological wounds, we have a great moral obligation to care for them. I sincerely believe that an elected official has no greater duty than to provide for those who have bravely defended our nation and our freedoms. Mr. Chairman, the focus of today's hearing is to look at what the committee has accomplished this year and look ahead to next year. We certainly thank the committee for its work in passing measures aimed to restrict protest at military funerals, enhance servicemen's life, provide veterans with a COLA, improve veterans' housing, and strengthen the VA's information technology and other matters. But I think it's more important to look at where we are today and examine the areas that need to be improved. I will focus my remarks on four issues: assured funding, veterans' mental health, the claims backlog, and the veterans' attorney legislation. First, with assured funding. Every time we send our young men and women into combat, we are asking them to make a huge sacrifice. Their lives and their health care are the real follow-up cost to any war. The VA budget for FY207 was a step in the right direction, but it does not go far enough to meet the needs of all veterans. Members of Congress touted that this is the first year the independent budget has been used to tabulate the VA's budget. I ask why. The independent budget has been in existence for over 20 years and has proven time and time again to be the most accurate estimate of VA's funding requirements. If you are to be serious about meeting the needs of veterans, use the independent budget figures in FY2008. Veterans' health care is an ongoing cost of war and should be treated as such. Access to quality health care has been compromised by budget shortfalls, rising medical costs, and a sharp increase in demand for services. The current discretionary funding formula pits VA against other agencies and billions in pork barrel projects. We believe the system needs to be fixed through assured funding. Contrary to some belief, Congress would not lose oversight if assured funding was put in place. Congress would retain supervision of VA programs, and additionally, VA would still be held accountable for how its funds are being spent and how well its programs are managed. In fact, most federal health care programs are funded through mandatory funding. Isn't it only fair to put our nation's sick and disabled veterans on the same level as these other entitlements? Second, our veterans' mental health services. Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom have resulted in the deployment of hundreds of thousands of troops since 2002. Approximately one-third of returning military personnel will need mental health treatment. For those who served in Iraq, 35% requested mental health services 1 year after deployment. We've learned from past conflicts that war has long-lasting psychological effects. But getting a handle on PTSD and other disorders is tremendously difficult. The effects vary for each person. Some never show symptoms, others show them immediately. And unfortunately, the VA has an uneven record of service to veterans with mental health needs. VHA must invest resources in programs that aid patients recover rather than managing and treating symptoms. VA should develop a continuum of care that includes case management, rehabilitation, peer support, work therapy, and other support services with an overarching goal of recovery. Additionally, VA must work hand-in-hand with DOD to help returning service members get their mental health treatment. We applaud Congress for putting into place special safeguards to ensure VA gives priority to veterans with mental illnesses, but more needs to be done. I encourage this committee to continue its efforts to help VA assist veterans on the long road to recovery. Third, our claims backlogs. The VA continues to experience challenges in processing veterans' claims. The backlog is at a critical stage, with significant errors numbering 100,000 per year. The average claim takes more than 6 months to complete, and appeals of denied claims can take as long as 3 years. Also, many experienced claim processors are reaching retirement age. According to VBA, it takes 2 to 3 years of experience for processors to achieve a productive level of expertise. Currently, about half of VBA staff has 3 years or less of decision-making experience. VBA needs to tackle this problem now. And AMVETS believes VBA is capable of reducing backlogs and improving error rates, but only if and when new technology, better training, more staff, and real accountability is implemented. That takes time and money, not budget cuts and staff reductions, which have been proposed in recent budgets. In fact, AMVETS is so passionate about looking at claims and other VBA challenges, we are hosting a national symposium for the needs of young veterans in mid-October. The symposium goals are to reach a consensus on the key problems facing veterans, offer solutions that will modify the system, and suggest how to enhance benefits for the National Guard and Reserves. In November 2006, the symposium will publish an action plan that will prioritize the steps needed to provide a modern benefits program and an effective delivery system. If you are concerned about the future of veteran benefits, I encourage you to support us in this endeavor and study our action plan. I am confident the symposium will provide Congress and VA with a report that will improve the system now and into the 21st century. Lastly, the Veterans' Choice of Representation legislation. AMVETS has serious concerns with the House and Senate bills. As you know, the Senate passed their version with a number of veteran benefits enhancement attached to it. We support the added language now contained in the Senate bill, except the attorney provision. VSOs provide free of charge excellent representation to any veteran, member or not, within the community. AMVETS has specially trained representative stations around the country to assist veterans in wanting to file a claim. We have access to the VA system, know exactly who to contact, and are acquainted with the people who make the decisions. We feel we provide a greater and more efficient service than any lawyer could. If attorneys are allowed into the system, it would overturn veterans' protections that have been in place since the Civil War. It will not improve the procedure or make it more efficient. Just the opposite would be true. The benefits system was designed to be an open, informal process. Adding lawyers to the mix will create a potentially hostile situation between the veteran and the VA. Furthermore, that the VA can't handle lawyers. Most lawyers do not have an understanding of veterans' law, the vast VA bureaucracy, or even know what is rightfully due a veteran. VA will no doubt be bombarded with calls from legal aides wanting to know exactly how the VA works and how to navigate the system. VBA is financially strapped as it is, and claims backlogs continue to grow without this added burden. I suggest the committee explore ways to reduce pending cases by fixing staff shortfalls, improving training programs, and holding claim processors accountable for the quality of their work. This is what's going to reduce the backlog, not attorneys. One last point I'll mention, Mr. Chairman, is the yearly VSO testimony. As you know, the VSOs traditionally presented our agenda before a joint committee on Veterans Affairs in the springtime. Last year, joint hearings were dissolved in favor of a full committee hearing, but it was held just days after the President released his budget proposal. This is clearly not enough time to review a budget as complex as the VA's. While funding for VA is one of AMVET's top priorities, our annual testimony addresses issues that go above and beyond the matters of just the budget. I am certain the committee wants complete and accurate views from the veterans community when it looks at the agenda items for a new Congress, which is why we ask these important hearings to continue next year. But please schedule them in March so we can provide you with a thorough assessment from our organization. In closing, Mr. Chairman, AMVETS looks forward to working with you and the committee to ensure the earned benefits of America's veterans are strengthened and improved. This concludes my testimony. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear here before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. McGriff. We appreciate your testimony. We'll move to Bradley Barton, National Commander, Disabled American Veterans. Commander, you're up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Veterans Affairs Committee, on behalf of the more than 1.3 million members of the Disabled American Veterans, I am honored to appear before you today to discuss the state of Veterans Affairs for the current fiscal year and upcoming year. For more than 30 years, I have been active in supporting DAV's mission of building better lives for our nation's disabled veterans and their families. And since my retirement from the legal profession, fulfilling that mission has been a full-time job for me. My fellow disabled veterans have placed their confidence in me as the national commander to carry their message to Congress and to the American people, and I will not let them down. As the current fiscal year draws to a close, we hear from VA officials around the country that health care funding shortfalls continue to hamper their ability to care for sick and disabled veterans. They are unable or unwilling to hire the needed medical staff, in large part because of problems with the current budget process. With just days before the new fiscal year, the VA still does not have an appropriations bill. For years, the DAV has voiced our concerns that the current budget process is a failure. It fails to serve veterans, it fails to serve the VA, and it fails the American taxpayer. It is impossible for the VA to plan for the coming fiscal year when it does not know what its budget will be or when it will get its allocation. And that's no way to run the second largest federal agency with the country's largest integrated health care system. The VA simply cannot function properly under those conditions. Although the proposed VA budget for fiscal year 2007 comes close to the levels recommended by the DAV and other co-authors of the independent budget, an additional $2 billion in discretionary funding is needed. We are also very concerned about another tight-fisted budget for FY 2008 and its impact on the needs of our nation's veterans. For years, the DAV has been fighting to make sure that veterans' health care is adequately funded and that those funds are available on the first day of the new fiscal year. Chairman, I call upon you to join the DAV and the entire veterans community in an open and frank discussion of the current VA appropriations process and how that process might be improved to better serve our nation's sick and disabled veterans. I will now turn my attention to an issue of great importance to the DAV and those veterans seeking benefits from the VA. Recently, the Senate passed S-2694, which would permit attorneys to charge veterans for services rendered in the preparation, presentation, and prosecution of their VA claims. There are also two bills in the House that would allow attorneys to charge veterans a fee to represent them, H.R. 4914, introduced by Congressman Lane Evans, and H.R. 5549, introduced by Congressman Jeff Miller. The DAV firmly believes that allowing attorneys to charge a fee to represent veterans would not be in the best interest of veterans and would be detrimental to the VA as well. As an attorney and a veteran who has considerable experience with the VA claims process, it is difficult to see how allowing attorneys to charge for their services will improve the situation. What ails the VA claims system has nothing to do with who veterans choose to represent them. The real issues are the timeliness and accuracy of the decisions handed down by VA claims workers. I can understand why some attorneys advocate changing the system, and some veterans honestly believe that they would receive better representation by attorneys. But empirical data from the Board of Veterans Appeals shows that attorneys have a lower average allowance rate than veterans service organizations. Veterans who fought for our country should never have to fight their government to get the benefits a grateful nation has provided for their sacrifices and service. Congress itself intended that these benefits be provided with a minimum of difficulty. It is important to understand the differences between the VA process and litigation. In the VA process, its employees counsel veterans on their eligibility for benefits. The VA will assist the veteran in completing and filing the relatively informal application for benefits. The VA also takes the initiative to advance the claim through the process, and Congress placed the duty on the VA to ensure that all laws and regulations pertinent to the case are faithfully applied. Admittedly, the VA has often fallen short. The VA sometimes denies veterans' claims erroneously, even arbitrarily. Veterans sometimes do have to fight the bureaucracy to obtain what they are clearly due. However, regular involvement of lawyers in the claims system would turn the informal, pro-veteran process into a formal, legalistic, and more adversarial one. The VA would have to devote a whole legion of employees just to review attorney fee agreements, for example. And the overall increase in administrative costs might have to be paid for by reducing veteran services elsewhere. A far better use of the VA's already limited resources would be to hire more claims workers and provide intensive training to improve the quality as well as the timeliness of decisions. The VA also must enforce uniform quality standards through more effective management and exercise real accountability at all levels. More timely medical examinations and better information sharing between the Veterans Benefits Administration and the VA healthcare facilities are also needed. Only when the VA has taken these steps and Congress provides the necessary resources, will veterans receive the level of service they deserve. The VA's objective and its duty is to provide timely, accurate decisions on veterans' claims. As you know, Congress deliberately designed the VA administrative claims process to be non-adversarial and veteran-friendly. Disability compensation and other benefits for veterans and their families should go to the intended beneficiaries, not lawyers. By passing a measure allowing lawyers to charge for claims assistance, this Congress would be admitting that it is unable to perform its oversight role to ensure that the VA claims system works as intended. The argument that veterans should have a choice to be represented by a lawyer ignores the intent of Congress that the VA provide all entitled claimants with all benefits affordable under the law. As an attorney, I know firsthand how lawyers are trained and how they think and react in the legal arena. Believe me, this is not what you want for the VA claims process. Enactment of these bills would profoundly change the claims process to the detriment of veterans. We believe there's a potential for wide-ranging, unintended consequences that will benefit neither veterans nor the government. DAV delegates to our national convention in Chicago, August 12th through the 15th, unanimously passed the resolution opposing passage of this legislation. The DAV does not stand alone in its opposition to these bills. This legislation is also opposed by the Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States and AMVETS and several other military and veteran organizations. And I remind you, the VA itself is opposed to this ill-advised change in the law. We therefore call upon the members of this committee to oppose the legislation that would remove the restriction on lawyers charging a fee to prepare, present, and prosecute claims for veterans' benefits. And on another very important matter, Chairman, I hope that you will give serious consideration to the DAV's request to present our national legislative agenda to a joint session of the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees on February 27, 2007. Mr. Chairman, this completes my testimony. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to appear before you on behalf of the disabled American veterans to share our views on the state of veterans' affairs. Thank you also for all that your committee has done and all that you will do for veterans in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Barton. We appreciate your testimony today and continuing to move along because we have a pretty healthy list. We'd like to ask the Director of Government Relations for the Blinded Veterans Association, BVA, Dr. Thomas Zampieri, if you would please proceed.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, on behalf of the Blinded Veterans Association, we appreciate this opportunity to present our views today and look back at 2006 and the priorities for 2007. This year, BVA has become increasingly frustrated by the lack of significant changes in the VA's ability to provide the full continuum of blind outpatient rehabilitative services. Before getting into that, though, I want to bring up a couple cases that have caused us a great deal of alarm. Recently, we found out that we're starting to find individuals in different medical hold companies in different locations around the country, OIF and OEF service members who have had severe eye injuries or have in some cases been blinded in combat that have been put in medical hold companies, and the VA has never been notified of their existence. We recently found a 22-year Navy corpsman who had been in the Navy Reserves, who was down at Camp Lejeune, and he was down there in medical hold for 4 months. He was discharged September 8th back to his hometown in Ohio, and his instructions were, when you get home, find the closest VA hospital and try to get an eye clinic appointment. We also found an active duty Army Sergeant Major at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, who had had traumatic brain injury and was legally blind, and much to our surprise, we found him on ABC Evening News when they were doing the story about the reduction in funding for the Traumatic Brain Injury Center at Walter Reed. Well, surprise, we found out that he has also never been referred to the VA, even though he's about to be discharged in October. And then yesterday, I find an individual, an Air Force service member out in Colorado, who was blinded in July, was discharged recently home to California. Again, the VA was never notified. These cases should begin to demonstrate our complete lack of confidence in the seamless transition, and makes me wonder what kind of complete disconnect there is between DOD and VA. We hear here frequently about how we have placed case managers at DOD facilities from the VA, and the VA comes in and testifies about how they're able to track these individuals, and these are just three examples, and I could give you about eight more of cases that we've recently found that have fallen through the cracks. In regards to traumatic brain injury, which I mentioned, this is a serious problem that's going to be confronting everyone. As of January 14, 2006, DOD reported over 11,852 of the returning wounded service members had been exposed to IED blasts or other types of explosions. With this came the report that over 1,800 service members are now diagnosed with traumatic brain injury from Walter Reed. They admit that this is the signature injury of this war, and the complications from blast-related injuries can be anywhere from mild, moderate, to severe. In our case, we're extremely worried because epidemiological research studies have shown that about 24% of all TBI patients have visual disorders. Some of these are extremely subtle, but they can have a major impact on the individual. Blurred vision, double vision, problems with distance, being able to read and interpret the print, all these things can affect them long term. We're concerned about the lack of screening of those at risk of TBI, and would urge this committee to ensure that both DOD and VA medical staff have training on identification, diagnosis, and appropriate management of TBIs. We also supported fully the Senate Defense Appropriations of $19 million, the amendment that was approved recently, and hope that the House will also approve this. Recently, Harvard and Columbia Universities took a look at where we're headed at, and the estimated costs of medical treatment for TBI service members in the next 20 years, the VA could face $14 billion in estimated expenses associated with traumatic brain injuries. We also are concerned, we found recently between March of 2003 and April of 2006 that Walter Reed Army Medical Center has now publicly admitted that 16% of all service members evacuated from Iraq had had eye injuries, that they had treated over 670 soldiers with either blindness or moderate to severe visual injuries, and that the Naval National Medical Center had operated on over 360 Navy or Marine Corps personnel who had had eye injuries. Much to our surprise, though, they refused to provide this information to the Department of Veterans Affairs, even though we had a meeting out there a couple weeks ago, because they said we have concerns over HIPAA, so we don't want to release these individuals' names and Social Security numbers and information to the VA. It's just astounding to us, not only from the standpoint of that statement, but also that the VA computer system won't be able to access their inpatient medical records, because the computer systems currently, at this stage, can only access four things, which are outpatient type of items, such as pharmaceuticals and outpatient labs and some other information. We wonder where this is going. For the full continuum of care, Blinded Veterans Association has constantly worked with this committee and with the VA on trying to get improved resources for blinded veterans, and especially those older veterans who have age-related visual impairments. The GAO testified in front of this committee in July 22, 2004, saying that the VA needed more additional outpatient resources for the full continuum of care. The VA Visual Impairment Advisory Board has examined and looked at this issue internally since then. They've made recommendations. VA did an internal gap analysis, which looked at what current services were available. And they found in the middle of all this, with the large numbers of returning casualties with eye injuries, that 80 VA medical centers currently, according to VA's own internal gap analysis, have no basic outpatient blind services for veterans. Only 14 medical centers in the entire system can provide the full scope of advanced blind rehabilitative services. The VA Visual Impairment Advisory Board also looked at the financial projections for expansion of low vision services and issued a report in November 2005 that the total cost to implement a cost-effective outpatient blind rehabilitative services would be less than $14 million. To this date, though, only one new program, outpatient program, has been established since July 22, 2004, when GAO testified before this committee. We would strongly like to urge that this committee pass H.R. 3579, the blind rehabilitative outpatient specialist that this bill would provide, would make a substantial step towards the right direction in providing more outpatient services at VA medical centers. Currently, three out of the four VA polytrauma centers didn't have a blind specialist on their staff, even though they're supposed to have full multidisciplinary staff at those centers. Until just recently, this spring, did they hire any of these individuals? There's two programs that would help not only with the traumatic brain injuries screening, but also with the older aging population with visual impairments. One is a VISOR program, which is a visual impairment services outpatient rehabilitative program, and the other one is a low vision optometry program, visual impairment centers to optimize remaining sight, called VICTORS. Both of these programs are outpatient programs. They're operated with the intent of being able to not only provide the full scope of services for outpatients, but also to be able to provide follow-up care for those veterans who need further care. The most of these programs are extremely cost-effective, and yet we've been unable to get the funding to establish 18 of these programs, which would be $9.5 million. We wonder then, when we hear about the robust budget, where the money is. Mr. Chairman, we appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on these critical issues and be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, Doctor. We'll move along to the Non-Commissioned Officers Association of America. Sergeant Major Gene Overstreet. Sergeant Major.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the committee. We are pleased to be here before you today, before this committee, and to share some of our perspectives on the VA as we look forward and look back. Thank you for implementing our written record into the testimony, sir. The association is grateful for you holding this hearing. We think it evidences the genuine concern as you look at the programs and resources provided by the VA. We also think that it weighs the future financially for the years in the future accordingly. This must be done to ensure that the resources and priorities are in place to honor this nation's institutional commitment to those who have served in the military. Please note that I emphasize for the VA to honor all our nation's commitment to those who have served, all those who have served. We cannot forget the service and sacrifices of our earlier generations as well as that are serving today. The honoring of the commitment to the military members and their families and our survivors with appropriate benefit health care all the way from when they separate or when they go on active duty all the way to the gravesite. As you can see today, I'm joined by a lot of veterans here. I had the opportunity to introduce the President of the United States a couple of years ago at Arlington Cemetery. And I said to him and all those great veterans that was watching that proceeding that, you know, I have a friend in San Diego. He's a retired Marine. He's a sergeant major. And every time he introduces himself, he'll tell you that he's a Marine. He'll tell you that he's retired. But the very next word out of his mouth, he'll tell you that he's still serving. Sir, ma'am, if you look around this room, all these veterans are still serving. We have a lot of veterans across this great country that are still serving. And that's why I say, let's honor all those who have served in the past. As we enter the second session of the 109th Congress, the nation's military force has more service women and men deployed in the war on global terror, and more military forces from the reserve and guard members on active duty for longer periods of time of any time since World War II. Most of them have deployed more than once. As a matter of fact, if the chairman was here, he would suggest after he'd went over there, most of them have served three and even on their fourth tour as they go. And every one of them, every enlisted member who will hold the right hand and swear to affirm the words of the military oath of enlistment. Simple words, but very profound to provide the very essence of service for every military man and woman of their ultimate declaration. These 12 words, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. I would submit to you, sir, that nowhere in there, and I've said this before and I will say this again, that there's any qualifying remarks in there about if resources is available or if we have the money to take care of you. I would also suggest to you, sir, every time from the newest recruit to that sergeant major or colonel or general that retires at the other end, I would suggest to you that they think when they raise their hand and say those words that they're going to get the best equipment and the best training that this nation can offer. I would also say to you, sir, if one of them should fall in the line of duty, that this institution will support those veterans from a grateful nation for them and their survivors, regardless of what that is. Like you and every veteran in this room today knows the freedom enjoyed by all Americans has a price. This nation's commitment to care for them who have borne the battle, their widow and their orphans, I would suggest to you, sir, that is the payment. Today we focus on a look back and a look forward. Meet the needs of America's veterans as we move forward in time. First of all, sir, I would suggest to you that productivity enhancements of information technology and artificial integration are still not online to work benefit claims. The claims backlog will further extend the claim timeline for processing. Sir, we need to hire a full-time employee to fill our perceived void. Those timelines continue to get longer and longer for claims processing all the time. The IT, we want to put a Band-Aid on this. It's not going to take a Band-Aid. We fully recognize that it's going to take 2 to 3 years to properly implement that. We think that that is going to happen. The bottom line is taking care of real, live veterans. That's the bottom line. We suggest that you need to do this. Obviously, there's no great need for a super-duper IT program. It manages the efficiencies and productivity. The issue right now is the process of the high volume of claims that we receive. As you know, we got more guard, more reserve, more whatever. The war is still going on. We recognize that the board remains in Blue Water Navy OA claims, anticipated Blue Water Navy DIC claims, and other veterans' appeal actions. Let's stop penalizing the veterans for the untimely final claim processing because of management snafus associated with the department's IT program. Training of all involved in the VBA claim process to include initial development of claims, reviewing the claims, submitting the process, reviewing telephone representatives and service. Make sure that they're accurate and giving good information. Train to meet qualifiable standards. We must do this to reduce the backlog. NCOA does not believe that the VA is adequately funded to complete its mission. Veterans sick in VA health care and services for the first time are well above projections. The war is not ended. More veterans are expected. NCO recognizes the fragmentation as it occurs in health care. Scheduling delays, past attempts to disenfranchise veterans from user fees, higher copay, locking out veterans, systems are signal of an underfunded discretionary health system. NCOA believes that it is time to make the VA health care system mandatory funding. Clearly, pressing issues for the VA today is their budget and their staff. We all understand that and know that. We need to establish long overdue Medicare Plus Choice programs. NCOA has not forgotten the 2002 vision of the Department of Veteran Affairs to bring subvention funding. Nor have we forgotten the envisioned income stream from TRICARE for medical reimbursement of non-service connected health care by medical retirees and possible dependents where feasible. It is time to review these efforts and enhance the funding capability of the VHA. Secure maximum reimbursement from insurance programs for those served by the VA health care system. Health care appointments, quality standards for those returning from OIF and OEF have not been really a hard difficult to secure appointments for entering the health care system. There is a severe shortage of mental health care staff and managing existing patients. Far less returning from OIF, OEF veterans who are required specifically as it's related to PTSD or other mental health. Shortage of mental health bed spaces for PTSD, substance abuse, alcohol abuse, drugs, suicide. There's a severe shortage of those. Homeless veterans are a rising number of veterans begin identified as homeless in America. Recent numbers project as much as 190,000, whereas we're going to have a shortfall not to be able to take care of that many veterans. You know, only a couple of years ago, we were arguing that it was less than 150,000. Within a year and a half, now we're over 190,000. What a shame. Growing numbers from OEF are part of those numbers as well, and that's really pushing the numbers up. That is evidenced by the report from the GAO. As we conclude today, sir, recently, and certainly are not our last recommendation, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Veterans, we place before you two concerns for your support as the VA moves forward. First, VA needs to secure its role in the medical research and development for programs designed for seriously war injured. I say again, seriously war injured. These programs would include research into the evolving new medical intervention and treatment of traumatic brain injuries and rehabilitation models for brain injuries. You may not want to hear this, but NCOA strongly is convinced that the administration in the VA should be an advocate for those medical research to pursue stem cell research for amputees, spinal cord injury, and nerve cell functional integration. We suggest, unless you do that, some veterans are going to be left behind. Second, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, NCOA believes that your efforts are needed to convince the Armed Forces Service Committee to revisit the health care record problem. VA has developed a nationally acclaimed computerized patient record system. It's a great system. The VA model could be tweaked for additional military data to include toxic exposures to meet DOD requirements and all the other requirements that they have. We have a good model on the ground right now that we know that works. Rather than someone creating their own paradigm that don't link up to the VA, and we can't even transfer the records from one to the other, And that's, you know, we're leaving a lot of people out of the system like that. We think, let's take a system that's proven system and develop it for both, because we think it will work for both. They have an effective medical record that can be communicated around the block or around the world at the same time. What does this do for seamless transition? This makes a seamless transition much easier and much more seamless than it's ever been before. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, NCOA thanks you for this time and appreciates the invitation to appear before you.
Thank you very much. The members were going to be in session until probably very late on the 29th, which is next Friday, which means a lot of the committees are doing markups on a lot of different bills and trying to gain access to the floor prior to the 29th. So I just want to let you know why members are not here and coming and going, and we're having a markup on NIH on the Commerce Committee, which I'm also a member. So I apologize for my absence. I did last night the opportunity to read your testimonies. And let me compliment you on the substantive nature of your testimony and also the oral presentations. We, in our negotiations at the moment with the Senate on pending bills, I have to go deep and into a narrow lane quickly. As I understand, so I can get this correct, with regard to the issue on attorney representation in the claims process, VFW opposes, is that correct? AMVETS opposes? DAV opposes? All right, that's not an undecided. Wholeheartedly opposes? Okay. And Mr. Barton, your organization. I'm sorry, Mr. Barton opposed. I'm sorry, doctors and your blind veterans opposes. NCOA.
We do not oppose.
That's a double negative, Sergeant Major. Do you support Larry Clegg's position, the Senate position? Okay, support the legislative position. All right, now let me go to the testimony of the four that oppose. With regard to a bill, Mr. Evans's bill, that would... I want to get the accurate language. Mr. Evans's approach would be an attorney could enter the process after a notice of disagreement has been issued. Would that change the position of the VFW at all? Would you still oppose? AMVETS?
AMVETS is still
opposed,
sir.
DAV?
Still opposed, sir.
Wholeheartedly?
Wholeheartedly. Emphatically. Definitely. We're opposed.
All right. It's a lot of adjectives. I got it. Blind veterans.
We would probably support that part of it.
Okay, so if it went with the Evans approach, then you would support. All right. That's important for us to know. Sergeant Major, that didn't change your position at all, I know. If you're hard over on that one, then you would also support the Evans approach. Would that be correct?
Correct.
All right. With the witnesses on the second panel, I have to go down the same questions, so please prepare for that. There was a question at the Subcommittee on Disability Assistance and Memorial Affairs when they held an oversight hearing on the operations at the Board of Veterans Appeals. The past president of the National Organization of Veterans Advocates stated, and I quote, as unsophisticated persons, claimants almost invariably lack the skills to determine what evidence they need to produce, What they need is a set of skills that experienced lawyers acquire. Now, from this statement, I believe the assertion here is that veterans and survivors are unsophisticated and require an attorney in order to receive the benefits from the VA, and that the system today has become too complex and adversarial. So I would like to know about your comments with regard to this quote. VFW.
No, I take exception to that quote completely. If that's in reference to the veteran or the veteran's family seeking the entitlement or towards the representation that we provide, that is not a true statement. We spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, all the organizations, on training our personnel for representation, and it's in a non-adversary position. The attorneys would only clog up the system so much more. So, and I'd like to make a statement. We just took and had our legislative conference here, and we charged the Hill, let's say, with them, and they made visits to many of the offices. And the lack of knowledge, let's say, on the individuals who will be deciding this, they weren't really up to speed on the issue. So if this does come forward, I would certainly like to see this go to a hearings first, if this ever is going to be acted upon. We have some real concerns with this because people were not even aware of it, a lot of the congressional people.
Ambetz?
Mr. Chairman, Ambetz is very proud of its Veterans Service Officer organization. Across this country, we have men that's their life. Their life is veterans serving veterans. They are fully aware of the ins and outs and the ways to go through the bureaucracy of the VA. And their only goal is to get that veteran what may be due to him. And this is at no charge to the veteran or to the veteran's family. And we spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year serving that veteran. I don't think you can take a brand new Jones & Jones law firm and have him equally represent a veteran as well as a veteran service officer can do it.
If a requirement was added that an attorney would have some form of certification with regard to veterans with the practice, would it matter?
I don't think so. Well, yes, it would matter. Let me re-answer that. Yes, it would matter if they had a certification. And there again, we get into the problem of getting the VA to certify them. And then there's going to be a cost, a delay, and a time of staff that is not necessary. Let's take that money to certify them and hire more VSOs.
Davey?
I would suggest that perhaps lawyers don't really have the skills to maneuver the VA claims process. I'm an attorney. And I speak with some experience in the area. I knew a lot more about the VA and the claims process as a disabled veteran than I ever knew as an attorney. Perhaps attorneys would aid them in presenting their evidence, but I think the empirical data from the Board of Veterans Appeals demonstrates that attorneys do not possess any special skills to make them any more successful than our outstanding group of national service officers with the DAV. And I think it would be a disservice to the veteran community to have to pay for representation to obtain benefits he's already paid the price for in his service and sacrifice for our country.
Blind Veterans Association?
Yeah, we're concerned with, as my distinguished colleagues here said, and that, you know, I don't come at this with a medical, with a legal background, but I do come at it from the standpoint of a medical background, where specialists are better at taking care of things than a generalist, depending on the particular problem. And when you get individuals who are going to be, quote, vying for business, then, you know, the free market system works very well, and individuals being able to target an audience, so to speak, and get people to sign up for services without fully realizing that their legal representative is well qualified in that area. And we, our claims benefits officers do a tremendous job of assisting veterans with their initial claims and are very successful in helping them through the process. And we would have strong reservations with that, ensuring that there's strong oversight and safeguards in regards to who is exactly going to be allowed to do this. You know, and the analogy I use is a plastic surgeon doing one thing and a dermatologist trying to do the same procedure. They're just not trained the same way. And there's a lot of risk out there. And I've followed what's happened with the asbestos situation. And I think anyone who's looked at the horror stories out there where individuals have cherry-picked large numbers of claims that they figured would have the best payout and have manufactured things in order to try to get large class action suits settled makes us very worried and suspicious of what might happen with this situation.
Given your prior testimony that you would support the Evans approach, would you, if Congress were to adopt that approach, would you advocate that the court require some particular types of certification or hours of training by a lawyer in order to practice in that process?
Yes, I think so, because there would be at least a safeguard in making sure that the individual has met certain standards before trying to accept cases.
Okay. NCOA?
Before being able to try to take cases, the individual would have to have met certain standards.
Sir, I think our concern is with the veteran themselves. They ought to have the option. It's kind of like going to Article 15. Do you have opportunity for counsel? Who are you going to get that counsel from? Chances are you're going to get it from the first sergeant, you're going to get it from the gunner, you're going to get it from the sergeant major, you're going to get it from someone in a pipeline that is raised in a pipeline that understand that. However, before you go before the commander, you have the opportunity to go seek counsel, legal counsel, either military or other. That's their option. We kind of see this sort of as the same way. Okay, you can go to the VSO. We have VSOs. We think they do a great job. We're not suggesting that in the least. However, if the veteran is not satisfied with a VSO he has or with any VSO that he talks to, we believe that he ought to have that option to go seek counsel otherwise. Now, as far as their training goes and as far as what they'll be able to do, maybe we need to hold that up to the light and see just how far they can represent this veteran in his claimant or whatever to get it through the process. However, when it comes down to the veteran, we think they ought to have that option, though.
Did all of you present your views and opinions to the Senate before they voted on this measure?
We did not, sir.
You didn't? Blind
no,
Association
sir.
Did? DAV did? AMVETS? VFW?
They told us we opposed it, but we did not have an opportunity to present it to them at the time.
There's no doubt that we opposed it now. Well, all right. Last comment I have, Sergeant Major, when we were in the theater with the Secretary and Mr. Salazar, and Dr. Roseman, the Marine Corps is still doing something right. You can spot a gunny from a distance.
Hoorah.
Every time I would meet one and walk up to him, there's a cookie cutter going on out there. I mean, whatever you're doing to these guys, they're built right, they sound right, they're leaders, and they're very impressive in the field.
Great.
So extend my compliments.
Thank you.
Whatever the basis that you laid, it continues.
Thank you.
Mr. Filner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for your introduction of these gentlemen. As you read their biographies, it shows us why we are here. And you could have done the same thing for every man and woman, I think, in the audience, and I appreciate knowing a little bit about their background, even the extinct fish one. So thank you for that. I just want to, the chairman gave me a good model, so I'll just proceed the same way with another issue, and that is, however you want to define it, assured or mandatory funding. And as I heard all of you, again, you were, I think, all for it. PBA? I mean, VFW? Yes? Wholeheartedly? Okay. All right, thank you. So all of these organizations are for that. And I think you've all been through the budget so-called process. I guess whoever said it's like watching a sausage made had it right. I mean, it's not a very pleasant process. It puts the veterans organizations in a sort of a begging situation, which should never be. I mean, we should beg you for allowing us to help, but I think we have to get out at it. You know, we have these arguments of these numbers, 2 billion, 4 billion, 1 billion, 3 billion. If we had a formula that everybody accepted and it was applied, I think we'd be far better off. Chairman Booyer suggested it would cost a hell of a lot of money. I'm not sure there's an agreement on those figures, but I wouldn't let that dissuade me right now. When we're, as I said earlier, when you have a $3 trillion budget and a $8 trillion deficit, several billions or even tens of billions more for the veterans is not out of our ability to do, and we should do that. I thank all of you for talking about mental health. It's an incredibly important area. We seem to have knowledge of how to deal with the physical, the great physical trauma, but the mental trauma is still one that we don't, as a society or even as a VA, I think, want to admit when we know how that is as debilitating as any physical injury. And we have to, I think, have not only mandatory counseling, but outreach to the families, a culture change which says, hey, it's all right to admit that. You got to confront it and deal with it. I was just out in San Diego, where I represent, the Vietnam vets had started a process which has now culminated in something called the Veterans Village, which basically institutionalizes the stand-downs. It brings everybody into a secure. They start off with just 30 beds. They're now up. They'll be up to 200 soon, and then 400. Of course, that doesn't begin to deal with the problem, but they give the veteran, obviously, some security and safety in terms of housing and comfort, medical, legal, mental health, job counseling, dental, whatever, is all brought into one unit, and we have a chance to make sure that these brave young men and women can make a recovery. It doesn't matter what we thought about the Vietnam War. It doesn't matter what we feel about the Iraq War. When they come home, we got to make sure they're served. And we know how to do it. And as moving as the Vietnam Vets program is out in San Diego, it serves 400. We may have 200,000, as was stated, homeless veterans. Which is we should never have homeless and veteran in the same sentence. This nation failed, I think, in that. So thank you for all keeping, we need to do that. And lastly, I want to have a chance for Mr. Michaud. Everybody said here, accountability. That's our job. And you've used different words for it, the quantifiable standards, you know, to deal with the claims, for example. And this committee should be working far more in an oversight capacity. I think we did, as I said to the chairman many times, the process of oversight during that data theft, I think, was a model of how the committee should work. We worked bipartisanly. We worked strenuously. We became knowledgeable. And we held people accountable. And I think that's what we have to do in all these other areas, too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Michaud?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank all the panelists as well. I'll be quick. Because of mild traumatic brain injury is not often diagnosed, many veterans with that conditions do not receive treatment. What do you feel that see as the urgent need to deal with this issue and the long-term need that we must do to address TBI? To any one of the panelists.
Let me take a shot at that. I think the talking to the providers at Walter Reed and over at Bethesda Naval Medical Center, you know, the proposal is four things. One is that, you know, you need to start to educate VA and DOD providers and being able to, in the history, being able to find those individuals who have been at high risk for explosions or blast injuries. And then in the screening process, educate the providers who are the frontline people in looking for the subtle types of problems that can manifest themselves, especially in regards to, there's a new syndrome out there, post-trauma visual syndrome, PTVS. And these subtle findings wouldn't be routinely picked up. And so the second part of this is having screening centers with individuals who have had the appropriate training and experience and be able to start to track those individuals and screen them and then provide not only care, for example, with a low vision VA optometrist, but then provide follow-up. And you know, this, and then the fourth part of this is the research part, which is looking at what types of treatments work best and, you know, collecting that information and then working towards future better results and improvements in therapies.
My second question quickly is, since we haven't passed the budget, have any of the VSOs heard from the VA staff the effect that that's having right now, i.e., that they're delaying hiring a vacant position or they're not providing services in a timely manner because they don't know what their budget's going to be? Have you heard any feedback from the field?
Feedback, Congressman. I think you what you do is when they don't have a budget in hand, is in the, everything that gets put on hold, new hires and things like that get put on hold. But if you really think about it, though, the pay raises that have been authorized, they go ahead and go through. Well, therefore, you immediately start it in a negative situation, and so then you have to be very careful of your spending on a continuum type budget. And so, yeah, it does put a strain on the system, and it puts one that's felt all the way down the line.
Yes, we've heard that. Matter of fact, the FTE may even be cut on the VBA side. So there's a real negative there on that aspect.
That's been our experience as well. We're getting reports from VA facilities across the country that they're having difficulty in meeting their staff needs because of resources available to them, which translates in slower service to veteran population.
Thank you. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having this oversight hearing. I appreciate the written testimony that all of you have provided, and I know that in many of those written statements and perhaps in your earlier testimony, you reiterated your various organizations' support for modernizing the Montgomery GI Bill. And as the ranking member of the Economic Opportunity Subcommittee, we've, I think, started to lay some very important groundwork, reaching out to all of you. Some of the field hearings that Mr. Bozeman and I have held, including one in Arkansas earlier this spring, Dr. Snyder's involvement as a member of the Armed Services Committee as well in undertaking that challenging task, but one that I think is very important, particularly for improving those educational benefits for our active duty military as well as the National Guard and reservists who have been deployed at much higher rates, as you know. I just have a couple of quick questions, and the first is on transportation reimbursement for your members. I'm hearing even more, not only representing many veterans who are in rural areas, but the significant costs associated with traveling for specialized care. And so if you could address that issue, as well as the VRNE program. We've had a number of hearings, as you know, about recommendations to improve that program, specifically a move from refocusing the program on employment rather than an education. And so has your membership noticed a difference in the VRNE program? And can you provide us with any additional recommendations to improve that program? If you could start with the transportation reimbursement issue, and then if we don't have time because of votes, if maybe you could just submit any comments you'd like to share in writing to the committee with regard to VRNE in addition to what may have been in your written statements.
Ma'am, I'm from San Antonio, Texas. We have a great VA hospital in the San Antonio area. However, that's the furthest one south that we have. All of those veterans that's south of San Antonio, all the way into the valley area, what we call the valley, has to pay their own way to get up to San Antonio to do their appointments. We have a couple of buses that try to run there. All of our organizations provide transportation. We provide volunteers. We provide all of those. However, if it's on the day, your appointment is on the day where we have no transportation, the bus is broke, or we don't have a volunteer to drive it, obviously that appointment gets set back. You probably know already the scheduling problem with a VA to get into the hospital as far as that. So here is a veteran that can't get there, whereas if we did have some kind of reimbursement for transportation and stuff like that, it would make it a lot easier for that veteran to schedule his appointment, schedule his transportation, and be there in a timely manner. So there is some problems with that. I suggest if there is a way that we could reimburse their transportation, we would support that.
Yeah, we would support an increase in the travel allowance for those veterans that have to travel, you know, long distances for their outpatient services. You know, the 11 cents a mile reimbursement rate doesn't cover much when price of gas is $2.90 a gallon.
And you also had a great differential also in what the IRS or federal rate is for mileage plus what the VA is for mileage. And it's a vast difference. I mean, it's that big. And a lot of this is caused by the fluctuating gas prices and transportation costs that everybody encounters. But the big difference between the 46.5 cents and the 11 cents, it grabs you. And that's what a lot of veterans have to depend on is the VA reimbursement rate, and it's too low.
The DAV recognizes back in the 80s when there was a dramatic change in the transportation for veterans to go to the hospital for cure, and that's when we come up with our program of the Van Transportation Network. We've transported 9.5 million veterans since we began our program in 1987. But yeah, anything you could do to improve that situation would greatly be appreciated by everyone.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars would certainly support an increase in transportation costs for our veterans to get back and forth for their medical exams and treatment.
Okay. Ma'am?
I think in light of the time, we'll, right. I did pose that other question on the VR&E program, but I all think right. that has been addressed to a degree in the written statements, and anything else you'd like to add would be helpful. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Two things to cover. Every war, we find something that's out of the norm that we then have to address. And TBI is the big one in front of us with the present conflict. To let you know on the forefront, or trying to get ahead of this one, I have been working with the services on the on protective issues, and that is the helmet issue and inserts. The Commandant of the Marine Corps, in working with the Commandant, he made the executive decision that to give the Marines the choice. We as a society, even though there some have financed some studies, we really don't know. But some of these inserts, to give you an idea, if you take that insert and you cut it in half and you look at the inside, it almost looks like a human cell. And it's built to absorb energy. So as we put all that body armor, you know, on the front and side plate and shoulder plates, neck plate, groin plate, you put on that brand new helmet that we've got them, and they strap it on with that football strap, and that blast comes in, and we've got them sitting in a vault on wheels. There's nothing to absorb that energy, and that energy goes to where it can be absorbed, and part of it goes up the face, and we get those maxillofacial injuries and the eye injuries that we talked about, and the ear injuries, and the then part of it is absorbed by the brain. So we end up with these traumatic brain injuries. So our research with regard to the brain injuries and that care, but also on the protective side. We're a smart people, and that helmet out there is the best in the world on ballistics, and it helps them on crash. But can we build a helmet that gives them, that doesn't compromise ballistic protection and can give them the blast protection? I don't know, but it's worth a try. And so I want all of you to know that's ongoing as we look at the other question. So I'll speak with the VA. I want to work with you. I appreciate your testimony and focus on that issue and the work that we're doing at the polytrauma centers. I know you join me in the kudos to the men and women out there who are caring for those patients. I agree with Mr. Filner in his comments on I am really proud of the committee. We did 8 hearings in a 6-month time frame, pretty hard on VA on the IT issues. And we've got a product. That product goes to the House floor next week. So I would ask for all of your support and advocacy of our product as we then take that up with the Senate. As you know, last year we had passed an IT bill, and there are no questions on this committee. It's a bipartisan issue. Senate didn't necessarily agree with us, and we ended up in a bad spot. So please, as we go into this and you formulate your independent budget, please address a focus on those IT issues, and we want to work with you. Okay? Ms. Surfis?
Well, I know we're running close on a boat, but I would just want to comment for the record. We have to be very clear on the costs we save in what we do to enhance the quality of care, the rehabilitative care, beyond 90 days for these young men and women suffering traumatic brain injuries, because improvements are necessary. I have a constituent who is now getting care in a private facility, and there were worries that because he hadn't made so much progress after 90 days, even though he wasn't getting his physical therapy every day, even though he wasn't getting any occupational therapy, no speech therapy, he has made more progress in 45 days at a different facility, a non-VA facility. And the cost savings that we can realize, not only the quality of care that he deserves, but the cost savings in not having a long-term care situation for these young men and women is very important as we look at the next budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. This panel is now excused. The committee will stand in recess. We will reconvene at 1:15. Veterans Affairs Committee of the House will come to order. Now introduce panel two, here representing the Military Order of the Purple Heart of the United States, is Tom Poulter, National Commander. Commander Poulter enlisted in the United States Army in February 1967 and was commissioned as a second lieutenant of armor in 1968. He served in Vietnam as a tank platoon leader with the 1st Battalion, 69th Armor, and was assigned to the 4th Infantry Division in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. On November 17, 1969, after battle with a company-sized enemy force of the 24th North Vietnamese Army Regiment near the Cambodian border, Commander Poulter was wounded in action by an AK-47 round by the enemy during an NVA counterattack while he was dismounted and consolidating his platoon's objective. Commander Poulter is an active member of the Sonoma County Chapter 78 of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, located in Santa Rosa, California, where he became a member in 1994. He is a past commander of his local chapter, the Department of California, and the commander of Region 6 that includes Guam, Hawaii, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Utah. Thank you for being here. Congratulations. Speaking on behalf of the Paralyzed Veterans of America is Mr. Randy Pleva.
Speaking for him.
Is Lewis Irvin. Is it Pleva? Is that how he pronounces it, though? Pleva? Mr. Irvin is PVA's executive director. Mr. Irvin served the United States Navy as a fire control technician and received a combat action ribbon during Operation Desert Storm. He suffered a spinal cord injury that ended his military career in 1992. He became a member of PVA in 1994 and began to serve PVA as the National Service Officer the same year. 4 years later, he was appointed to PVA's National Board of Directors, and in 1999 was accepted to the position of Executive Director of PVA's San Diego Chapter in California. Representing the Gold Star Wives is Ms. Rose Elizabeth Lee. Rose is the widow of Colonel Lee, the United States Army, who served in Korea and Vietnam. Colonel Lee died on active duty overseas in 1972. In 1978, Rose was appointed Gold Star Wives Washington representative and has been active through most of that time. Rose is Gold Star Wives National President from 1991 to 1993 and Chair of the Board of Directors from 98 to 2002. She just served as the Potomac Area Chapter President from June 2004 to 2006. All her work with Gold Star Wives is voluntary, and her mission is to train the new young widows to become involved with legislative work. Rose has appeared representing the Gold Star Wives before this committee for a number of years. And I understand that your national president, Ms. Joanne Young, is here in the audience today. Thank you very much for your attendance, and I welcome you both. I also understand that it's your charter that does not permit Ms. Young to testify, and that's why Rosalie is testifying on your behalf. Would that be accurate, ma'am? That's accurate? All right, thank you. Here representing the Fleet Reserve Association, representing their national president is Edgar Zier, is Mr. John Davis, Director of Legislative Programs. Mr. Davis, a former Marine, served in the artillery unit in the early 1980s and later received a direct commission to serve in the Army National Guard. He joined the Fleet Reserve Association as a team as director in February 2006. You know, I'm looking for your vast bio for the Vietnam Veterans of America, and I just can't find it. But Mr. President, you've testified before this committee, and we've enjoyed working with you. I just hate to be redundant. It's so vast, so I'll not bore everyone. You're such a humble man that you've restrained me from reading your bio. Next is our final witness will be the new National Commander of the American Legion, Paul Morin. the of Massachusetts was elected national commander on August 31st, 2006. The commander is a Vietnam veteran of the United States Army, an active member of his post 337 in Massachusetts. He has served as department commander and as member of the national commissions, including children and youth, foreign relations, public relations, and convention. He has chaired the Veterans Affairs and Rehabilitation Commission, as well as the Legislative Employment Commissions, and served on the Legislative Council and Commission. He is was honored in 2001 by the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Tony Principi, with the Secretary's Award for his service to our nation's veterans while President of the National Association of States Veterans Homes. In 2002, he was awarded Outstanding Citizen of the Year by the Sampson World War II Navy Veterans, and 2004 received the Outside Award from the Massachusetts Veterans Service Officers Association. On March 31, 2005, he received the Distinguished Citizens Award from the Grand Lodge Order of the Elks. Congratulations to all of you, and thank you for being here. Do all of you have written testimony you seek to submit before the committee? All acknowledge in the affirmative. Do you offer such testimony? All acknowledge in the affirmative. So testimony will be received without objection. So ordered. Each of you will be recognized for 10 minutes, and we'll give latitude, and we'll start with you, sir. Mr. Poulter, Purple Heart Association.
Chairman Bullier, Acting Ranking Member Filner, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tom Poulter. I'm the National Commander of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. It's an honor to appear before this distinguished body on behalf of our members of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. As you are aware, our order is very unique in that we are among the service organizations, the only one, because our membership is comprised entirely of combat wounded veterans who shed their blood on the battlefields of the world while serving in the armed forces of our country. I am accompanied today by National Adjutant Bill Bacon, National Service Director Jack Leonard, and National Legislative Director Herschel Gober. I have turned in a written testimony, and I'll make my comments very brief, Mr. Chairman, but this committee is extremely important to the Military Order of the Purple Heart and our members. We look to you to represent the veterans of our country and to ensure that all members of Congress understand that America must keep its promises to those men and women who have served and are now serving in uniform if we are to maintain a viable military and continue to enjoy the freedoms that we have. Veterans have earned their entitlements and benefits, often as a part and parcel of the contract that each had with this government. Veterans' benefits are not a gift. They are not a welfare program. They are earned from service to country. They must not be diminished in any way. First point I'd like to make is, and it's been covered several times, is the adequate funding for the VA Health Administration. Military Order of the Purple Heart is on record as supporting the independent budget, which is developed and submitted to Congress by the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Disabled American Veterans, Paralyzed Veterans of America, and the AMVETS American Veterans. I am the fourth national commander of the Military Order of the Purple Heart in a row to again stress that our number one priority must remain the adequate or assured funding for the VA Health Administration. The Military Order of the Purple Heart joins our fellow veteran service organizations in urging Congress to find a long-term solution once and for all to the annual funding crisis at the VA. VA deserves a budget system that will deliver funds to them on time to allow for long-term planning. While the ongoing war on terror and our service members returning home from war with medical conditions requiring treatment at our VA hospitals, the VA must have the capability to meet their medical and emotional needs. The funding problem was demonstrated, of course, last year when the need to provide a supplemental appropriation for fiscal year 2005 surfaced, along with the need to amend the fiscal year 2006 budget. So it's real important, and I think it's been mentioned by every other veteran service organization that we get a fix on this. My number two item is the award of the Purple Heart Medal to those POWs who have died in captivity. While the award of the Purple Heart Medal to those POWs who died in captivity is not under the purview of this committee, the Military Order of the Purple Heart believes that those military personnel who suffered hardships, wounds, or illnesses, including starvation, brutality, slave labor, and a lack of medical care while held in POW camps, and then they died in those camps as a result of this internment, should be considered as combat casualties and eligible for the award of the Purple Heart Medal. Our order has supported legislation that was introduced in both houses of Congress that would authorize the posthumous awarding of the Purple Heart Medal to these veterans. Language in the House version of the 2007 National Defense Authorization is currently in the conference committee, and the Military Order of the Purple Heart requests that members of this committee urge the conferees to retain this provision in the final act. The next point is retired pay restoration. Military Order of the Purple Heart is very pleased that Congress enacted legislation that authorizes some military retirees with 20 or more years of service to concurrently receive without penalty or an offset both their full military retired pay and any VA compensation to which that they are entitled. Our position is that all those eligible for concurrent receipt should receive it. And going along with that, the combat-related special compensation, known as CRSC, our order supports the legislation to provide for the additional payment of CRSC to former members of the military who were retired medically, serving less than 20 years of active military service because they had to be retired on a medical basis, and they were awarded the Purple Heart Medal. Now, a lot of the veterans organizations ask why we push those. A lot of our members are in that category. And so CRSC is very, very important to the members of our order. Fifth point is the Survivor Benefit Plan, SBP, and the Dependency and Indemnity Compensation, DIC. SBP was an investment by the member with their own money. The Military Order of the Purple Heart supports language in Senate Bill 2766 and the 2007 Defense Authorization Act, which, if enacted, will repeal the reduction of survivor benefit plan annuities by the amount of dependency and indemnity compensation and will change the effective date of the paid-up coverage for SBP, bringing it forward from October 1st of 2008 to October 1st of this year, 2006. Survivors of retirees who died but elected to pay into SBP and survivors of members who died on active duty should receive both SBC, SBP, and DIC without the current dollar-for-dollar offset. This bill is now in the conference committee. We request that you urge your colleagues who are serving on the committee to adopt the Senate language of S-2766. Another point that I wanted to make on the Stolen Valor Act. The Military Order of the Purple Heart supported House Bill 3352 and S-1998 addressing stolen valor. It is unfortunate, especially with our country engaged in ongoing conflicts, that we have these imposters out here who fully and knowingly misrepresent their service. Not a matter of inflating your resume, it's a matter of lying and misrepresenting your total service and any of the military awards that they have received. This is not just an occurrence now and then, but is regrettably becoming a huge problem. This legislation would provide for fines and imprisonment for those wannabes who dishonor the medals for valor and the Purple Heart Medal, and those brave men and women who have legitimately received these medals. The Senate passed Senate Bill 1998 2 weeks ago on September 7th, and we urged the House to do the same. These phonies are taking benefits away from those who have earned them. Some receive VA disability for no service that they ever had. They get license plates, including the Purple Heart license plate, from the DMV, where they don't have the people that are trained to really look at a DD-214 or a certificate, and it is a big problem. Now, That particular bill in the House, of course, was introduced by Congressman John Salazar, and it's been in the House Judiciary Committee since July of 2005, last year. Military Order of the Purple Heart will continue to seek legislation that would authorize the military exchange and commissary privileges for all recipients of the Purple Heart Medal. This would recognize the sacrifices of those service members who have given so much for our country. The National Purple Heart Recognition Day. As most of you are aware, the Badge of Military Merit, which was a predecessor of the Purple Heart Medal, was established by General George Washington on August 7, 1782. This is the oldest decoration in the United States. It's the oldest decoration in the world given to the common soldier. Next year, on August 7, 2007, the Military Order of the Purple Heart is celebrating its 225th anniversary of this decoration at our 75th National Convention in New Windsor, New York, which is a historic cantonment center in the last encampment of George Washington's army. We will be seeking sponsors, co-sponsors, and support of legislation to establish a National Purple Heart Recognition Day, which will honor this anniversary and those members, past and present, who have been awarded the Purple Heart Medal. Mr. Chairman, will you sponsor this legislation and seek co-sponsors? We would be very honored if you would do that. In conclusion, I'd like the members of the committee to recall the quotes of two very famous Americans. First of all, General Douglas MacArthur once said, and I quote, "The soldier above all other prayers for peace, for it is the soldier who must suffer and bear the deepest wounds and scars of war." And then President John F. Kennedy said, and I quote, "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, in order to assure survival and success of liberty." The Military Order of the Purple Heart supports all of our brave warriors, both male and female, who serve and fight to protect our freedoms in the global war on terrorism. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony, and I'll be pleased to answer any questions from the members of the committee.
Your testimony. Mr. Irwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. On behalf of Paralyzed Veterans of America, as the new executive director, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. In my statement today, I will highlight some issues that have been submitted in our written testimony. In May, the House of Representatives approved the fiscal year 2007 appropriations bill that will fund $25.4 billion for VA medical services. Although this does not quite meet the recommendation levels of the independent budget, we are glad to see that Congress and the administration have made reasonable effort this year to meet the needs of the VA healthcare system. We particularly appreciate this committee and Congress rejecting the proposed enrollment fee and increased prescription drug copayments recommended by the administration. Congress also approved legislation in previous years to establish 8 priority enrollment groups for VA healthcare. We believe veterans in Category 8 should be allowed access to the VA healthcare system. Also, veterans with catastrophic disabilities were allowed to enroll in Category 4, even though their disabilities were non-service-connected and regardless of their incomes. However, they would still be required to pay all fees and copayments. PVA believes, because of the nature of their disabilities, they require a lot of care and lifetime of services. Many times, VA is not only the best resource, it is the only resource for a veteran with a spinal cord injury. These veterans should not have to pay the fees and copayments necessary to receive the specialized services. PVA was pleased that the committee recommended a significant increase in funding for medical and prosthetics research in its budget views and estimates. Unfortunately, the appropriations bill only provided an increase of $13 million for a total of $412 million. Research is an essential mission for our nation's healthcare system. VA research is still grossly underfunded in comparison with the growth rate of federal research efforts. One area we remain concerned about is funding for construction projects. The appropriations bill provides nearly $1.15 billion less than the independent budget recommendations for major construction. The bill also provides no funding for the new spinal cord injury center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or funding for the replacement medical center in the Denver, Colorado area. We would also identify the committee that in the Denver area, there is a new spinal cord injury center to be identified with that medical center. The appropriations bill also provides $295 million less than the recommendations for minor construction. Many VA facilities require significant upgrades and overhauls. The VA appropriations subcommittees in the House and Senate inserted language in their VA funding reports for fiscal year 2001 requiring VA to establish centers of excellence to conduct research in the field of neurodegenerative diseases prevalent in the veterans population. VA identified two fields of inquiry for these centers, Parkinson's disease and multiple sclerosis. The VA then established the Parkinson's Disease Research and Education Clinical Center and the Multiple Sclerosis Centers of Excellence. In 2001, these centers represent a successful strategy to focus the Veterans Health Administration on system-wide service and research expertise to address the critical care segments of the veteran population. Early this year, the Senate approved S-2694 that would make permanent the authorization of these centers. We urge the committee to adopt legislation which would codify these centers in Title 38. PVA is also concerned that the VA continues to experience a serious shortage of qualified board-certified spinal cord injury physicians. In some VA hospitals, the recruitment of a new chief of service has been prolonged with acting chiefs assigned for indefinite periods of time. We are even more concerned about the continuing shortages of nurses, particularly in the spinal cord injury units. PVA believes that basic salary for nurses who provide bedside care to the spinal cord injured veterans is too low to be competitive with the community hospitals in the area. This leads to high attrition rates as these nurses seek better pay in the community. Recruitment and retention bonuses have been an effective tool for several SCI centers. Unfortunately, these localized efforts by individual VA medical facilities We believe the Veterans Health Administration should authorize substantial recruitment incentives and bonuses to retain these highly professional and qualified nurses. PVA calls on Congress to conduct more oversight on the VA Health Care Administration in meeting its nurse staffing requirements for the SCI units as outlined in VHA Directive 2005-001. PVA is also concerned with recent trends to reduce the ability of the VA to provide long-term care to the aging veterans population. The Veterans Millennium Health Care Act benefit, Public Law 106-117, required VA to maintain its 1998 VA nursing home average daily census mandate of 13,391 beds. VA's average daily census for VA nursing homes is projected to decrease to a new low of 9,795 beds in fiscal year 2006. The VA is ignoring the law, serving fewer and fewer veterans in its nursing home care program. PVA strongly feels that any repeal of the capacity mandate will adversely affect veterans and a step towards allowing VA to reduce its current nursing home capacity. This is not a time for reducing VA nursing home capacity, with the increased number of veterans looming on the horizon for long-term care. Furthermore, we urge the committee to conduct an aggressive oversight to ensure that the VA is fully funding statutory obligations to provide long-term care. PVA would like to offer a few improvements to benefits provided by VA. PVA members are the number one beneficiary for the Special Adaptive Housing Grant and the Automobile Adaptive Grant. For both the Special Adaptive Housing Grant and the Automobile Grant, we believe an automatic annual adjustment index to the rising cost of living should be applied. Furthermore, the independent budget recommendations recommends the adaptive automobile grant should be increased to 80% of the average cost of a new vehicle to meet the original intent of Congress in creating that legislation. The House of Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Economic Opportunity considered H.R. 4791 earlier this year. We hope this committee will move this legislation forward. We've also identified some critical issues for fiscal year 2008, as requested by you, Mr. Chairman. The independent budget for veterans service organizations recently began planning for the fiscal year 2008 by developing some critical issues. First, we believe the adequate funding for veterans health care is essential, as mentioned by my associates. We continue to stress the need for budget process reform, removing VA health care funding from the discretionary process and making it mandatory. Second critical issue is mental health care. It has become more apparent that many service members returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are experiencing psychological disorders. It is imperative that we do not allow these men and women to slip through the cracks. Third, as previously mentioned, we have a serious concerns about the construction and infrastructure. VA construction projects have suffered in recent years as a result of a moratorium on new construction resulting from the Capital Assessment Realignment Enhancement Services, the CARES process. This has also led to a significant backlog of critical maintenance and infrastructure upgrades. We hope that this committee and Congress will devote serious attention to the infrastructure needs of VA in the upcoming year. Once again, this year, the claims backlog is one of our critical issues. We have appreciated this committee's efforts in recommending an increase in 200 full-time equivalent employees, full-time employees for direct compensation to improve the claims process. Unfortunately, the Military Quality of Life and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Bill does not include additional funding to allow the VA to hire these staff. Another continuing issue for the independent budget is the seamless transition of service members. The seamless transition includes not only health care services, but benefits as well. We are advocating for a single electronic health record for all transitioning service members to ensure that VA and the military can best provide their health care needs when necessary. We believe the VA electronic health record is the standard that should be set for all federal health care records. Finally, Congress should continue to invest much-needed resources in the National Cemetery Administration. With new national cemeteries opening this year and next, we must ensure that the National Cemetery Administration can properly maintain these national shrines. In the end, all veterans and their family members should be provided a dignified setting in their national or state veteran cemeteries. PVA appreciates the opportunity to present our views today, and I'll be more than happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Slee, you're now recognized.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Representative Fillmore, and members of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony to you on behalf of all Gold Star Wives to review last year and look forward to this coming year. My name is Rose Lee. I am a widow and the chair of the Gold Star Wives Committee on Government Relations. I wish to thank many Gold Star Wives for attending this hearing today who are in the audience. You've already acknowledged Joan Young, our national president. We also have Martha DiDamo, our chairman of the board. And then we have some members of the Government Relations Committee, which include three of the newer widows of the Iraq War. And then, of course, our members of the Potomac chapter, our local chapter. They're all back here, and I just want to let them know that we appreciate them being here. The Gold Star Wives of America, Inc. was founded in 1945 and is a congressionally chartered service organization comprised of surviving spouses of military service members who died while on active duty or as a result of a service-connected disability. We could begin with no better advocate than Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt, newly widowed, who helped make Gold Star Wives a truly national organization. Mrs. Roosevelt was an original signer of our certificate of incorporation as a member of the board of directors. Thank you for this opportunity and for your continued support of programs that directly support the well-being of our service members, widows, and their families. Gold Star Wives applaud the efforts of this committee, knowing that together we can continue to make a difference in the lives of this group, a group that no one would choose voluntarily to be a part of. It is imperative that the difficulty of the sacrifice of our husbands' lives be mitigated to the degree possible by providing support for the survivors. There are many issues still pending before the Congress that mean a great deal to the membership of Gold Star Wives. As we are moving forward, now is the time to close out some of these legislative issues. Gold Star Wives has no greater priority than to eliminate the offset to the Survivors Benefit Plan, SBP, dollar for dollar by the amount of the Dependency and Indemnity Compensation, DIC, stipend. You are well familiar with this topic. We have been addressing this issue for several years, and I want to thank Representative Henry Brown for introducing H.R. 808 on this issue. In essence, a service member's disability results in voiding or reducing the benefit that the service member purchased, the SBP. While this is an issue being addressed in conference of the fiscal year 2007 National Defense Authorization Act, we urge you as individuals and as the committee together to encourage your colleagues to make this right. DIC is within your jurisdiction. All we are seeking is to assure that survivor benefit plan annuities for those eligible will not be reduced by the amount of dependency and indemnity compensation to which they are separately entitled. This is an issue from last year. It is a current issue. We would urge your help that this not become an issue for next year, but be resolved in this session of Congress. We have been pleased with the interest in the House and by Representative Bill Arrakis in particular in providing for decreasing the remarriage age for retention of survivors' benefits to age 55. You will recall that the current public law permits surviving spouses who remarry after reaching age 57 to retain their VA survivor benefits. It also provided for a one-year period to apply for reinstatement for those who remarried before the law was signed, but that period expired in December 2004. Because the retroactive period was limited to 1 year and outreach was limited, many eligible survivors may not have been aware of their eligibility to be reinstated. Mr. Bill Arrakis's H.R. 1462 is a bill that we need to focus on now to address these issues. It is time to get it done. We have testified before this committee previously and before the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission for a review of the DIC program to ensure that all veterans survivors are covered adequately and have equity with other federal and military survivor benefits. There are some widows dependent only on their monthly DIC check living below the poverty level. Current DIC is set at $1,033 monthly, which is only 41% of the disabled veterans compensation paid by the VA. Survivors of federal workers have their monthly annuity set at 55% of the disabled retirees' compensation. We seek to raise DIC payments to 55% of the current VA disability compensation. That would improve the DIC payments to $1,316 monthly. As you can see, we are not seeking exorbitant amounts. We're simply seeking fairness across the government to modestly help deserving survivors. Therefore, we again ask the committee for a review of the DIC program. Recently, I received this letter, and it reads, quote, "Thank you for the requested DIC review. Since my benefits began in 1957, which was before the SBP was in effect, it seems that the increases in DIC have not progressed as have other survivor programs. The cost of living has increased so much it is extremely difficult to keep up with it. At age 79, I am still working, trying to pay debts. and wondering how to pay the undertaker. If there is any way we who are dependent upon DIC survivor benefits can be of assistance in the execution of this review, please inform us. Sincerely, unquote. There are inequities among payments for the child survivors that need attention. The additional monthly $250 child DIC payment per family only applies to survivors of deaths after January 1, 2005. This should be linked to October 7, 2001. We thank Representative Michael Michaud for introducing H.R. 1573, which provided for this additional payment to families. It makes no sense that the survivors of those who died first should be prohibited from accessing a benefit given to survivors of those who died later in the same war. Thanks to Representative Shelley Berkeley for introducing the amendment, which was approved by the House, to include a COLA for the $250 DIC allowance per family. The lack of COLA has dropped the value of the allowance to about $240 this year. We request the committee to assure that these inequities be corrected. We also seek to provide a dental plan to beneficiaries of the Civilian Health and Medical Program of the Department of Veterans Affairs, CHAMP VA. With no coverage now, Gold Star Wives seeks for widows and all CHAMP VA beneficiaries the ability to purchase a voluntary dental insurance plan. There are a few other issues that need attending that have been brought to your attention previously. There are widows whose husbands died in a VA hospital due to wrongful VA hospital care who receive only DIC without any other VA benefits under Title 38 U.S. Code 1151. We urge the committee to support the measures necessary to allow these widows to be entitled to the CHAMP VA benefit. We are seeking legislation to remove the disabled under age 65 Part B penalties and interest for late enrollment to CHAMP VA and promote a feasibility study to convert VA facilities to long-term care facilities which would welcome widows and widowers. Yes, I just have very little, Mr. Boyer. Thank you. Surviving spouses who are on active duty should be able to use the educational benefit derived from her deceased husband while still serving on active duty. Currently, the active duty widow must resign from the military in order to use the derived educational benefit under Chapter 35. Not in my written testimony is something about mental health. It is an issue affecting widows and children. It's become more prevalent recently. I've heard from new widows about this more and more. VA's vet centers provide counseling, which is wonderful, but it is not always nearby. TRICARE does not provide grief counseling either. Finally, Gold Star Wives supports the creation of an office for survivors with the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Defense to ensure improved delivery of benefits, information, and benefits to survivors. In conclusion, we want neither our widows nor their children to be forgotten. We can understand and encourage your attention to the needed services of the service member who serves our country, who may return wounded, who may give his life. When the latter occurs, we want you never to forget the family he leaves behind. They have made their own personal lifelong sacrifice. We ask again to show the spirit of this nation by not forgetting these widows, unfortunately, whose numbers grow daily, and their children. I thank this committee for opening this opportunity to hear us again and allow for further awareness of issues facing survivors daily. We will be happy to continue to work with the committee and devote our time and resources on all issues impacting survivors. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Mr. Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the committee, the members of the Fleet Reserve Association appreciates this opportunity to review the past fiscal year and look ahead to the next year. The FRA extends sincere gratitude for the concern, progress to date generated by the committee in protecting, improving, and enhancing benefits that are truly deserved by our nation's veterans. FRA appreciates Chairman Steve Boyer and the House Majority Leader meeting with FRA National President Ed Zur in June to discuss the data security problem at the Department of Veterans Affairs. One of the more worrying aspects of the case is that the data theft was not reported to the Secretary for 2 weeks. It was originally reported that less than 50,000 names were stolen, when in fact the theft of personal information from the home of a VA employee included more than 26 million veterans and more than 2 million active duty personnel. Even though the data was recovered and apparently not accessed, the VA and Congressional Oversight Committee should continue to pursue improvements in the data security at VA. We hope that data theft security isn't like a shooting star in the legislative arena that's very, very bright at the beginning and then quickly burns out and everyone forgets about it. Even more recent theft apparently indicates that data security at the VA is going to be an ongoing concern with veterans, with the news that a computer containing information on up to 38,000 veterans treated over the last 4 years at two VA medical centers in Pennsylvania is missing from the Virginia office of a VA contractor. If there is any silver lining in this episode, it is that upon learning the computer was missing, the VA took immediate steps to notify the appropriate senior VA leadership, congressional offices, committees, VA's Office of Inspector General, and other law enforcement authorities, including the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. FRA appreciates the efforts of the House Veterans Affairs Committee and its Senate counterpart for their tireless efforts to improve data security at the Department of Veterans Affairs. FRA fully supports the legislative effort of this committee that culminated in Chairman Booyer's introducing and the full committee approving H.R. 5835. The bill aims to create more accountability at the VA for data security. It would create an Office of Undersecretary of Information Security and would require the VA to report to Congress any data theft and would provide credit monitoring and fraud remuneration for affected individuals. Additionally, the bill would require a study on using personal identification numbers rather than Social Security numbers for veterans' benefits. The full House should expedite passage of this important legislation as soon as possible to give the Senate an opportunity to pass this legislation for the President's signature before the end of the 109th Congress. FRA is mindful that legislation alone cannot fully remedy an internal bureaucratic culture that gives data security a low priority. But FRA believes, the public expects, and the veterans community demands that it is now time for Congress to do their part to help correct this problem. FRA strongly supports adequate funding for DOD and VA health care resource sharing in delivering seamless, cost-effective, quality services to personnel wounded while participating in Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, other veterans, service members, reservists, military retirees, and their families. That is why FRA supports the recent executive order to require federal agencies which handle health care to work together to implement a standardized electronic health record. The agencies, including the VA, will coordinate with the Department of Defense so that the clinical information can be interchanged efficiently. A standardized electronic health record will make sharing information between health care providers more cost-effective for everyone and will eliminate the cost of record duplication. FRA also supports H.R. 4992, sponsored by Representative Kelly of New York. This bill changes the law to allow the VA to bill Medicare, which would enable veterans to use Medicare coverage to help them pay their bills at a VA hospital. It is puzzling to our members why this program has not been given serious consideration and enacted long ago. With regard to the VA medical and prosthetic research, the VA is widely recognized for its effective research program, and FRA continues to strongly support adequate funding for medical research and for the need of the disabled veterans. The value of both programs within the veterans community cannot be overstated. Noteworthy is the fact that the FY 2007 proposed VA budget for medical and prosthetic research shows only a slight 1% increase in the most successful aspect of all VA medical programs. FRA is concerned about relying on other government agencies to help support and fund important research related to disabled veterans. FRA endorses recommendations from the Committee on the Budget to convert the veterans' health care account from discretionary spending to mandatory spending. FRA understands the jurisdictional and other challenges associated with this issue and believes the veterans' health care is as important as other federal benefits funded in this manner. Regardless of the methods used, the Association supports any efforts to help ensure full funding for VA health care to ensure care for all beneficiaries. FRA supports claims processing, I'd like to talk a little bit about claims processing. Claims processing delays are a continuing concern. VA can promptly deliver benefits to entitled veterans only if it can process and adjudicate claims in a timely and accurate fashion. Given the critical importance of disability benefits, VA has a paramount responsibility to maintain an effective delivery system, taking decisive and appropriate action to correct any deficiencies as soon as they are evident. As stated in our February testimony, VA has neither maintained the necessary capacity to match and meet its claim workload, nor corrected systematic deficiencies that compound the problem of inadequate capacity. Rather than making headway and overcoming the chronic claims backlog and consequent protracted delays in claims disposition, VA has actually lost ground on the problem, the backlog of pending claims growing substantially larger. And now, even the Court of Appeals of Veterans Claims is experiencing a growing backlog of cases. FRA commends the chairman for his statement at the December 8, 2005 hearing on VBA claim processing and agrees that, quote, the increase in disability claims can be directly related to the increase in U.S. military operations abroad. Doing more with less is not a strategy for success, end quote. An increase in staffing levels within the VBA claims processing system is essential to moving forward to reduce this backlog. The FRA appreciates Chairman Bowyer's and the committee's interest in the MGIB reform and supports provisions in the Senate version of the NDAA that allows reservists to draw benefits up to 10 years after leaving the reserves. Currently, only active duty members can draw benefits after service. The Montgomery GI Bill is important and aids in the recruitment and retention of high-quality individuals for service in the active and reserve forces, assists in the readjustment of servicemen and women to civilian life after they have completed military service, extends the benefits of higher education to servicemen and women who are not able to afford higher education, and enhances the nation by providing a better educated and productive workforce. Double-digit education inflation is dramatically diminishing the value of MGIB. Despite recent increases, benefits fall well short of the actual cost of education at a four-year public college or university. In addition, thousands of career service members who entered service during the VEEP era but declined to enroll in that program, in many cases because of government advice from government officials, have been denied an MGIB enrollment opportunity. In addition, the nation's active duty, guard, and reserve forces are effectively being integrated under the total force concept, and education benefits under the Montgomery GI Bill should be restructured accordingly. FRA supports the Total Force Montgomery GI Bill for the 21st century. The FRA supports integration of active and reserve forces program, MGIB program, under the Title 38, and is very, very important and will provide equity of benefits for services performed, enable improved administration, and facilitate accomplishments of statutory purposes intended by the Congress for the MGIB. Currently, mobilized reservists must leave behind MGIB benefits upon separation unless the separation is for disability. I'd like to talk a little bit about the National Cemetery Administration. FRA is grateful to the committee for recommending an additional $14 million in NCA operations and maintenance and an additional $60 million NCA construction for 2007. As part of the Veterans Education and Benefits Act of 2001, the government is to provide grave markers to veterans whenever requested, even if there is another marker on the grave. However, as written, the law only applies to burials after December 27, 2001. FRA supports H.R. 3082, which would repeal this expiration and expand application options for veterans buried in private cemeteries. FRA is thankful to this committee, Congress, and the President of the United States for approving H.R. 5037, the Respect for American Fallen Heroes Act. We appreciate that, and with that, I'll end my testimony and wait for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representing the Vietnam Veterans of America's National President John Rowan, who was elected VVA's 12th National Convention in Reno, Nevada. enlisted in the United States Air Force in 1965, 2 years after graduating from high school in Queens, New York. He went to language school where he learned Indonesian and Vietnamese. He served with the Air Force 6990 Security Squadron in Vietnam and Okinawa in helping direct bombing missions. After his honorable discharge, he began college in 1969, receiving a BA in political science from Queens College and a master's degree in urban affairs at Hunter College. He recently retired from his job as the investigator for New York City's Comptroller's Office. Prior to his election as VVA's national president, he served as VVA's Veterans Service Representative in New York City, and he was founding member and the first president of VVA's Chapter 32 in Queens. National President Rowan, you're recognized.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Bouyer, and Ranking Member Filner, and distinguished members of the committee. On behalf of the members and families of Vietnam Veterans of America, it is my privilege today to offer our comments concerning what has been accomplished in the arena of Veterans Affairs during FY 2006, what remains to be done in the waning days of this fiscal year, and what needs to be addressed by this committee in fiscal year 2007. First, let me review the simple and straightforward legislative agenda of VVA. First, to secure adequate resources to properly administer the network of services that our nation's veterans have earned. This includes a more adequate sum for operation of VA medical centers and other vital health care functions. It also included increasing the number of adjudicators in the compensation and pension system, counselors in vocational rehabilitation and education. Second, we ask that you and your colleagues take action to greatly enhance the accountability of all employees in the VA, but especially managers and political appointees. This would include being held accountable for accurate adjudication decisions as opposed to just moving the files forward in the C&P service as it appears to be the case now. It is also ensuring that contracts are drawn in such a manner as to systematize the reporting of contracts and unit costs with an eye towards getting the most goods and services for the least expenditure of each taxpayer dollar. It would also include greater accountability in regard to access to medical and other services, as well as clinical outcomes. Third, we ask that you take steps to greatly enhance outreach by the VA to inform veterans of their earned benefits at the VA and elsewhere in the federal government. We've had some movement in the first two and, unfortunately, nothing in the third. As to what did happen this year, VVA commends you on your activism in tackling some of the issues of critical importance to veterans, particularly our newest veterans. You have sought to give real meaning to the term seamless transition, to force the active cooperation between the VA and the Department of Defense in providing assistance to newly minted veterans transitioning from active duty. You've also pushed the VA to greatly improve the way it conducts its business in regard to information technology. And you have rejected the Office of Management and Budget notion that the copay for prescription drugs be increased and a user fee be imposed on certain veterans who avail themselves of the VA health care system. We don't need to belabor the whole laptop computer theft problem just to know that VVA supports and applauds your legislative initiative to resolve these deficiencies within the VA. And we hope that that becomes successful and we will work to push the Senate on that legislation. However, numerous initiatives that have been started have yet to be completed. These include cutting the enormous backlog of cases awaiting adjudication by personnel of the Veterans Benefits Administration. We know that Undersecretary of Veterans Affairs for Benefits Cooper is focusing on this problem. We hope his will not be the same fate as that of former Secretary Principi, whose goal to significantly cut this backlog was defeated by the backlog. It's interesting to note, too, that IOM report on PTSD talked about the fact that the VA needed to utilize its own methods for adjudications of C&P exams and PTSD, which unfortunately would lengthen some of the process and would also require more assistance in the VHA side. VVA maintains that if the VBA is to make a permanent dent here, it needs more adjudicators who are well-trained, can pass rigorous competency-based examinations, and are properly supervised. And these adjudicators must endeavor to get it right the first time. Quality control is of essence here. We think that you'll find that most veterans are okay with the DNC process itself. What they're upset about is how long it takes before a decision is rendered and or lack of sharing the reasons for rejection in a clear manner if their claim is denied. BVA thanks you and your colleagues on both sides of the aisle for taking action to, that led appropriators in the House to add on to the amount slated for the veterans' medical care system for research and especially for adding additional adjudicators and VRE&E specialists. We really want to thank you, Congressman. We know you took a big initiative on getting that additional FTE on the VBA side. About the only thing that could be said good about the VBA is that their computer systems are so bad that nobody can probably steal information from them. And it's really unbelievable how different it is between VHA and VBA. One is getting awards and the other is totally useless and needs to be, unfortunately, a significant amount of funding needs to be put on that level. And with the IT programs, hopefully, it's nice to have somebody in charge, but if they don't have the funding, they're going to be in trouble. Assured funding is still an issue with us, and we urge and hope that a bipartisan effort that will be made to rectify the situation in the next Congress. We hope that like minds from both sides of the aisle can come together to grapple with this issue with input from the veteran service organizations, propose a legislative solution. Any solution, of course, must contain provisions for accountability. This is likely an initiative for the 110th Congress, unfortunately. We hope that the current Congress will address and pass appropriate legislation that will permit veterans to secure legal representation when filing claims for disability and compensation before the Veterans Benefits Administration, as was passed in the Senate. We know that some have expressed fears that such a bill will only make adversarial of a process that should be cooperative. We believe the process is already adversarial. I've served as a service rep for 3 years, and I believe that that's to be the case. Others worry the passage of this bill will herald the demise of veteran service organizations. I really don't think that's going to happen. We have no complaints with the people who are doing the veteran service rep work out there, service officers that are doing yeoman work. I have never seen an underworked service officer, ever. In fact, what the problem is, we don't have anywhere near enough of them, especially if we really try to reach out to the veterans to explain to them what their rights are. And unfortunately, many of them do not know what their rights are. I know there's some concerns, and I think we can deal with those, about what kind of attorneys we're going to have in here. Having gone through the Social Security process with my son, who had to file for disability, we had to incur an attorney on that process, because otherwise we would never have made it through it. And I think that those kinds, the same kind of attorneys, are going to do the same kind of work for veterans that they do on the side of Social Security, which is where you can look to see how that system will or will not work. We also applaud Mr. Thompson of California and Mr. Rayberg of Montana, who have long been in favor of H.R. 4259, the Veterans' Right to Know Act. This bill would create and empower a commission to look into the testing of chemical and biological weapons to determine if health issues suffered by veterans who participated in these tests might have been caused by toxic exposures to this test. We know that jurisdiction over this bill is in the Armed Services Committee, but you, Chairman Bouillet, and Ranking Democratic Member Filner have significant weight with that committee. We also ask that you hold a hearing or just take action to extend the authority of the VA to provide a full physical with a national protocol for all veterans who participated in any chemical or biological weapons research, such as Project 112, Project SHAD, or any other activities by any branch of the federal government. Similarly, we urge you to take steps to extend such authority for such examinations for those exposed to Agent Orange and other toxins in the Vietnam theater of war. Regarding PTSD, and I'm running out of time, in regards to Congressman Filner's remarks earlier, we know how to treat it. We believe we do. Problem is, we don't have the funding for it. And it's not just the new folks coming home. And certainly they are a big part of this problem. The real problem is still Vietnam veterans. Many veterans we're finding as they retire out and come home and don't have to be workaholics anymore, a lot of things that they were able to hide in the box for the last 40 years come back to haunt them. Secondly, they sit at home and what do they see on TV? A war very similar to the one they saw, where people are blowing them up on every given day. And we see death all around us, and it just brings back all kinds of things. The other thing, too, is many people did not file claims for PTSD because they were afraid of the stigma, which is an issue we even have with the new veterans. And that may have been inhibiting them for all these years. Now when they're retired, they don't have to worry about losing their job if people think they're crazy. And it's a real issue. And I think it's going to be a real issue of getting the newer veterans to come in and get treated. At least they know what it is. We didn't. The other thing true is secondary PTSD for the children and the families of veterans. In Australia, they treat the children of Vietnam veterans up to the age of 35 now for secondary PTSD, because that one of the studies they did found an extraordinary suicide rate amongst the children of Vietnam veterans over there. There are many other issues that we would push for, including a Montgomery GI Bill, as many of the others had put forward. We also believe that we're concerned about the – I really listened – being coming after listening to the blinded vets really intrigued me. Many Vietnam veterans, because of their Agent Orange-related diabetes disabilities, are going to have vision problems, and they're already having vision problems. And it really disturbs me to listen to my colleague from Blinded Vets telling me how poorly the VA is handling vision issues. And I can tell you as a service rep, I've had a lot of retinopathy cases, and you know, watching veterans in their 50s and 60s go blind. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Rowan. Commander?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member of the committees, for this opportunity to be here representing the American Legion and its 2.7 million members. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce the National President of the American Legion Auxiliary, Joanne Cronin, and the National Commander of the Sons of the American Legion, Earl Rostowski, and the five National Vice Commanders who represent the Crossroads of America. With
sure.
How hot is it?
Yeah, pretty hot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
He wants the picture.
With young American service members continuing to answer the nation's call to arms in every corner of the globe, we must now more than ever work together to honor their sacrifices. As veterans of global war and terrorism return home, they are returning to the VA not only for health care, but also for assistance in transitioning back to the civilian world. In order for that to occur, veteran service organizations must be afforded the opportunity to present testimony before the committees that oversee the operations of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Chairman, while I am thankful for the opportunity to address this esteemed body, the American Legion is extremely disappointed in your decision to cancel the joint hearings with the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Historically, the Veterans Affairs Committee in both the House, in both houses has been an example of bipartisan progress. However, that seems to be quickly fading norm. Legionnaires from all over the country have traditionally traveled to Washington, D.C. to attend the Commander's Joint Hearing and to visit with their congressional delegation to express their concerns for veterans' issues. We owe it to the brave men and women who have served and who are now serving to work together to ensure VA is funded at levels that will allow all enrolled eligible veterans to receive quality health care in a timely manner. As national commander of this great organization, I stand ready to work with you to accomplish these goals. In an effort to provide a stable and adequate funding process, the American Legion fully supports assured funding for veterans' medical care. Under the current discretionary funding method, VA health care funding has failed to keep pace with medical inflation and the changing needs of veterans' population. VA has been forced to ration care by denying service to eligible veterans. VA has had to forego the modernization of many of its facilities and the purchase of necessary state-of-the-art medical equipment. VA is subject to an annual funding battle for limited discretionary resources, and Congress has had to provide emergency funding to cover budgetary shortfalls. Additionally, the current discretionary funding process leaves the VA facilities administrators without a clear plan for the future. The American Legion urges this committee to support legislation that would establish a system of capitation-based funding for VHA. The Veterans Health Administration is now struggling to maintain its national dominance in the 21st century.
health care with funding methods that were developed in the 19th century. No other modern health care organization could be expected to survive under such a system. The American Legion believes that the health care rationing for veterans must end. It is time to guarantee health care funding for all veterans. The American Legion believes that Congress should allow the VA to bill, collect, and retain third-party reimbursement from Medicare on behalf of Medicare-eligible veterans. Nearly all veterans pay into Medicare for their entire working lives. However, when they are most likely to need medical services from the hospital system designed specifically for them, they must turn elsewhere because VA cannot bill Medicare. This is wrong, and I urge you to join in the fight to correct this injustice. Additionally, all third-party reimbursements, co-payments, and deductibles should be added to the budget, not counted as an offset against it. The American Legion firmly believes that making the VA a Medicare provider and designating the VA medical care as mandatory funding items within the federal budget will enable the VA to fulfill its mission to care for those who have borne the battle. The American Legion is disappointed in the slow progress in the local advisory panel, better known as LAPS process, and the CARES initiative overall. Both Stage 1 and Stage 2 of the process included two scheduled LAP meetings at each of the sites to be studied, with the whole process scheduled to conclude on or about February 2006. It wasn't to April 2006, after nearly a seven-month hiatus, that Secretary Nichols announced the continuation of the services at Big Spring, Texas, and like all other sites, it had only been through Stage 1. 7 months of silence is no way to reassure veterans' community that the process is alive and well. The American Legion continues to express concerns over the apparent short-circuiting of LAPS and the silencing of its stakeholders. The American Legion urges Congress to hold the VA accountable and to ensure that those locations that are still awaiting final decisions and address as soon as possible. Veterans in Las Vegas, Orlando, New Orleans, Denver, and Biloxi deserve to know the future of their health care delivery system. Upon conclusion of the initial CARES process, then-Secretary Principe called for $1 billion a year for the next 7 years to implement CARES. The American Legion continues to support that recommendation and encourages the VA and Congress to move forth with focused intent. The American Legion recommends a separate $1 billion for the implementation of CARES in FY 2008. Mr. Chairman, the American Legion appreciates the strong relationship we have developed with this committee. With increasing military commitments worldwide, and it is important that we work together to ensure that the services and programs offered through the VA are available to the new generation of American service members who are now returning home. You have the power to ensure that their sacrifices are indeed honored with the thanks of a grateful nation. The American Legion is fully committed to working with each of you to ensure that the American veterans receive the entitlements they have earned. Whether it is improved accessibility to health care, timely adjudication of disability claims, improved educational benefits or employment services, each and every aspect of these programs touches veterans from every generation. Together, we can ensure that these programs remain productive, viable options for the men and women who have chosen to answer the nation's call to arms, a very honorable profession. The brave men and women who are serving in our armed forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the world deserve no less. I look forward to working with each of you through the next year to improve the lives of all American veterans. Thank you for this opportunity. Mr. Chairman, I know of interest to you from your kind meeting with me yesterday. Resolution 149 of the Salt Lake Convention we just concluded. I will read you the resolve clause. The American Legion is National Convention assembled in Salt Lake City, Utah, August 29, 3106. That although the American Legion does not oppose the concept of attorney representation or the lifting of the current restriction on attorney representation in the VA system, the American Legion is opposed to any such measure does not include adequate safeguards, including but not limited to fee limits, training requirements, and or competency performance certification requirements, and strict agency oversight to ensure the protection of the client. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
You want to switch chairs?
Okay.
Commander, how many resolutions did you pass at your convention?
222.
Could you get those to me?
Sure, we'll be more than happy to.
All right. I would ask that you provide them to me, but not make them part of the record. I mean, that's a lot of print. But if you could please get those to me, I would appreciate that.
Yeah. I'll be more than happy to.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and start right there. Now that I know the Legion's resolution, let's go down the line here with the question that I asked about attorney representation. Faced with the language that I have that came out of the Senate, Purple Heart.
Mr. Chairman, we, as an organization, we have not taken an official position up to this point. However, as National Commander, I think I can speak for our members, and I think that this process could really tie the Veterans Administration appeals process in a lot of knots, and I've got my own personal feelings. I think it's more about lining the pockets of attorneys as opposed to taking care of our veterans.
All right, and if we were to, I'm going to go down the line so everybody gets to cover this. If we were to go with Mr. Evans's approach about a lawyer is not permitted until after notice of disagreement, would it change your opinion?
The training, we have National Service Officers, and they go through very extensive training to get their accreditation through the VA. I can't imagine the amount of training that the attorneys would have to go to get online with this whole thing. They'd have to go through the same training, and it takes a long time to get that accomplished.
All right. The question before us is, though, at what point would an attorney representation access the system? At the very beginning or at the notice of disagreement?
Has
no impact upon your opinion?
I don't think at the beginning. I think that, if later on somebody has to, an attorney, you need an attorney, okay, then that would be all right.
All right. Mr. Irwin?
Yeah, Paralyzed Veterans supported the Lane Evans bill, but at the same time we provided comment with regards to attorney fees and the safeguards, similar to what the American Legion just mentioned with regards to representation. The Senate bill, we do not support just because it brings the attorney in the first part of the claims process. We feel the VA still needs to have a system that provides a duty to assist, does the proper outreach to veterans, and assists them with filing their claims.
Ms. Lee, does your organization have an opinion on this?
Gold Star Wives have not discussed it among our members, so I'm going to pass on this.
Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Davis?
We do not have a position either, but we do believe that there's a causal relationship between the claim, the processing delays, the claim delays, and the call for legal representation. And instead of addressing the issue directly of legal representation, we think focus ought to be on fixing up the system so there are less delays, less complexity in the system, and that will, we think, reduce the
You got my agreement on that. On that, Mr. Ron.
Well, as I pointed out, we're in favor of it. We have been in favor of it. We think a lot of the same arguments were made when we talked about instituting the Court of Veterans Appeals.
Okay, we're going to narrow you here. You favor the Senate's view on this or Mr. Evans's position on it?
Mr. Evans's opinion is just a version of it. We support it all. We want have no problem with the lawyers involved, period.
Either of them.
We just think it opens up the whole access to getting somebody to somebody to help the veteran go through what is an onerous process.
Commander Morin, I know you're under restrictions with regard to your testimony. Am I to Can you go beyond what this resolution has said? I mean, can I ask you whether or not you would support the Senate approach or the Evans approach?
No. We do not support any bill. We support use of attorneys within the VA, but what we want to see is restrictions in the bill that says there shall be a limit on attorney fees.
All right. What
about... There shall be a limit...
Okay. You don't have to read that to me again. What about when they would access the system?
Whenever they wish. If they want to wish from the beginning to hire a lawyer and there's these safeguards in place, let them go ahead and do it. I mean, to me, as a veterans advocate, and as any veteran service organization, we have an outstanding service office in all our organizations. That's available for free of charge. And we would hope that would be the first avenue every vet would use. But there's also some mistrust to us by our fellow own veterans. And if they feel that comfortability of going to a lawyer versus coming to us, so be it. As long as if there's safeguards in the law. And I stress that because we don't want to see in the law saying that the VA will regulate what the fees are or what the educational training requirements are.
You know, not often. When I look back at the 14 years I've been here, do we end up with a situation whereby you are in such complete counter back azimuth of DAV, VFW, and MVETS? Why do you think that is? Why do you find yourself in a complete opposition of them?
The wishes of our members at our national convention through a resolution adopted this. And this is, as I have said, I speak from a resolution form.
In your personal opinion.
Yes.
Why do you think Legionnaires are in such complete opposition of AMVETS, VFW, and DAV?
I think they feel that it only opens a process. It opens another door if veterans wish to use it. And our own concern is that there's stipulations that the veteran would not be hurt by it.
All right. Mr. Filner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank both panels here today. Your testimony was very helpful. I admire your expertise that comes from both your active duty status and your long-time service to your members. And you know the system inside and out. And we learn from that, and I appreciate everything that you said. And maybe with the one exception, Mr. Booyer, there's a real unanimity on almost every issue. I mean, I suspect that we could have a list of whether it's 20 or 50 items, all of you would agree to it. And I will tell you, I don't know whether I will be in this chair or that chair next year, but you have given us the agenda for next year. And I pledge to Mr. Booyer, whichever position I'm in, to work with you to try to realize as much of that agenda as we can. I mean, there's remarkable unanimity on things. I want to say to Mr. Poulter, when the chairman introduces the bill to recognize National Purple Heart Day, I will want to co-sponsor it with you. And congratulations on the 225th anniversary, and we look forward to that celebration. Several of you mentioned the conference of the defense bill, authorization bill. I am told that has been concluded, although even as a congressman, they wouldn't tell me what the results were until the report is published. But I had the sense in regard to the Purple Heart for those of POWs who died under non-combat, but obviously in our view, combat situations, that they acceded to the Senate position, which set up a commission to study it. We will try to get that next year if that's the case. I don't know that, but that's the impression I got that they and I don't know what they did, Ms. Lee, to the SBP-DIC offset in that conference, but we'll find out, I guess, in a day or so. But thank you for being so following of that. Mr. Irvin, I San Diego's loss is Washington's gain. Congratulations on your new position. You didn't mention in your bio that he's also recently married a very beautiful woman, so we congratulate you on that. And I want to thank you for your position on the sense of who gets services at the veterans' hospitals and benefits. By definition, probably all your members are in a high category, but you want the VA to serve all categories, and I appreciate that very much, and thank you for that position. The PVA just recently had a 60th anniversary gala, and I was at the dinner, and I saw you give awards to Secretary Principi, Secretary Mineta, that were so well deserved. Of course, the King Richard Petty also got an award. But thank you for allowing myself and my wife to be a part of that gala. It was very moving evening. And I know each of you have those kinds of evenings, and they're all they're very moving to see, to talk to your members and to meet them on a more personal basis and see their dedication to improving the lot of everybody around us. So thank you all. I look forward to working on it. I mean, this is set up by the chairman as a preview for next year. I think we have our agenda pretty clear in front of us. And I look forward to working it. Ms. Lee, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, regarding the attorney issue that you talked about earlier, are survivors included in the bills that are mentioned? Lane Evans' bill, I hadn't seen that at all. It is. Okay, thank you. I guess we need to get a copy of that. Thank you.
I apologize. I just thought you were asking the chairman. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Ram.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and certainly thank the members of the panel for being so patient. You can understand our schedule where we get unscheduled votes, and we'll have one coming up pretty shortly again. But I just wanted to just address a couple of issues, I guess, as it was brought up, and we appreciate the testimony, and I think Ms. Fillmore's right. I think that y'all have given us some criteria for next year's appropriations if we can't get them done this year. But next week we're going to have a hearing at next Thursday at 10 o'clock on PTSD and TBI, and we got some professionals coming in to give us some insight on that. And then on the construction bill, this is the first construction bill we actually passed in about 15 years, and I know we have some problems sometimes with partisanship, but it was really great to the way the bill was addressed in the committee and then went on the floor. And normally we have like 20 minutes for the proponents and 20 minutes for the opponents, and both sides talked on the bill, and so it passed unanimous, which is kind of unusual for anything to happen in the body today. But I know we addressed some of those issues that was mentioned earlier, the construction of Biloxi at $310 million, in New Orleans $100 million, and Charleston $70 million, and Denver $98 million. And so I'm hoping that the Senate will be able to soon reconcile with them so we can go ahead and get this signed by the president. And in that initiative, and we're going to need some support from y'all to help with this. I know there's been a lot of misinformation about our trying to combine some services between the VA and the local hospital. And I know in Charleston we're looking at trying to combine some services with the VA and the medical university there. Already there's a lot of sharing of resources with some 95% of the doctors that actually treat the patients at the VA hospital come from the medical university. And you know the cost of equipment is becoming, exorbitant, really, to try to have everybody to own one piece. I know we got one imaging piece of equipment. Now we're trying to coordinate between the VA medical universities and imaging equipment that actually can go in and identify a cancer cell, and they can go in and actually treat just the damaged cell and not impact the good cells. But that's a $6 million purchase, and everybody in town can't have one of those. We went to New Orleans, and we actually saw, the VA hospital went down with Section of Nicholson, we went to the VA was actually flooded in the basement, but just down the street was, you know, of course, LSU Medical Center, Charity Hospital, you know, two or three other hospitals all in one row, and probably duplicating the same piece of equipment. So we believe that this is going to be a system that's going to be able to deliver high-quality service by having specialized services available to all the veterans at one location, and be a savings to the taxpayers too. But anyway, we also, every time that we talk about it, even when we passed the bill on the House, we made sure that the VA had top priority on any of the services that's being provided. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back the balance of my time, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention and certainly solicit your cooperation and understanding as we work through this process.
Thank you, Chairman Brown. I'd like to make a couple of comments, and I have a question. This deals with the issues on seamless voc rehab and TAP. The Subcommittee on Economic Opportunity held several hearings. They've also had site visits on these topics. Overall, as with an examination of any system, you find some shortcomings, but measured on the whole, what we've learned, the TAP has been a reasonably successful program. The student reviews that we've seen so far have been very favorable. The seamless transition, I know the VFW had made some comments earlier as to whether or not they questioned whether or not they could actually point to anything that was successful. This one's going to be a maintenance issue for as long as we're involved in these issues. It really is. And I spoke with over 230 cardiac care physicians yesterday, and I deal with these issues on the Health Subcommittee of Commerce as we try to bring IT and try to figure out a standard in order to perfect these electronic medical records for our country. And trying to do that in a competitive marketplace, not easy. I just want you to know. And I tried to share with them the challenges of just trying to get DOD and VA to be able to cooperatively work together. It was great disappointment that the Department of Defense, in particular Dr. Winkenwerder, would not turn to the VA and use our standard. That was very disappointing to me. I've had my challenges with Dr. Winkenwerder. I respect him. He's a smart man. We've got to be able to work through this. But if we can't even get it right, how are we going to expect as a society for us to get it right? And I assure you that I do not want the federal government to select a standard out there. If you want us to get it wrong, government can choose a standard. I mean, we're right now in what I would call the beta VHS war. And I assure you, if you'd asked the government to solve that one, we'd have had beta. I mean, so I just want to let you know there's some big, big issues that are going on out there. I also am very pleased. Some of you know I've worked with the Olympic Committee for the last 6 years, not only in the reorganization of the Olympic Committee. That gave me a lot of great insights and a lot of great contacts, not only with these great athletes, but also the leadership. And then to extend that into the Paralympic movement, and bringing those veterans into the cooperation with the Olympic Committee, a lot of great success stories. And I only get goosebumps by what's happening out there. We have over 320 of our disabled veterans have participated in four of the Paralympic summits. 10 of these athletes have been identified as superior athletes at the highest level. So I just wanted to give you an update on that. I'm really pleased about that progress. I do need your help, and it's not just me. It's Mr. Filner, myself, Chairman Brown. This committee needs your help, and it's in the issues of we can't even hope to perfect seamless if we can't even get the VA to centralize its information technology architecture. And this is a huge challenge. It's very easy to be critical of them, but please, I'm asking you to engage with us in a constructive dialogue whereby we can move from the decentralized model to centralized. We can preserve incubators of initiative, But we've got to do that, and at some point we have to be able to bring in the software development into the centralization and empower our CIO and CISO. Very, very important. And I need your help and assistance to do that. So when this committee moved out last year and wanted to do that, we weren't crazy after all. And the rest of the government is looking. And hopefully we can do this. Mr. Fillon and I, next week, will go to the floor, and we will pass our product that we worked after our 6 months of effort of our oversight. And I'm most hopeful that we were stonewalled by the Senate in the last year, that hopefully that they will recognize that we have a great investment in this issue and knowledge and respect that. And I want to work with them. They work on issues that we don't work on. We can't cover the entire waterfront, as you know. I mean, it's a vast enterprise in front of us. And so there has to be some give and take back and forth here between the Senate. So as we move into the spring, I just ask all of you to help us with the IT issues. They're not sexy. They're not, don't get all the attention. You know, they're not that feel-good issues, but they're so vital and they're so important. So I'm asking for your help and assistance in that. With regard to adaptive housing, I want to continue to work with you. We recognize that we took on those issues to liberalize those standards. I know Ms. Herthas got some issues out there, but my commitment is, as we go into next year's bill, is take another look at that. One of the really good byproduct of this hearings that we're doing here over the next 2 days is we take this, we assimilate the information, we create a marker. And that marker then is then as I work with ONB and the VA. This is a new process. So it's not been done before. And like anything anew, some people don't like to change. So I embrace what you said, Commander. You don't like it, but you know what I've done is I embraced exactly what I shared with you yesterday when I had that phone conversation with Commander Bach, and he said, you know, we separated ourselves from the rest, and we wanted to put them ahead of time. I embraced that, and I also like that look back, look ahead, and that's what we've done here to lay a marker. And so I want to thank you for your testimony. We were receiving the testimony of 21 VSOs and MSOs, and it'll be that thick. And I assure you, I'll share it with Mr. Portman. There was one other. Mr. Filmer, if you've got anything left, I'll let you go, because I know I've got one that's just...
Let me just, Mr. Rowan, I just want to make sure that if he's Mr. Bouye, I'm Mr. Filmer. Okay? So... And I want to just point out for the record that it's the first time in his career, he said about third sentence to the end, the transcript will say it, he wanted to liberalize the restrictions. So he's moving in our direction. Thank you so much, Mr.
I heard that. You're not going to make it as a comedian, okay? It's not. You're not. Stick. Go ahead. You know, I've drawn a blank. It was. This was the question I wanted to ask. To the American Legion, of your 223 resolutions, did any of them address the issue on information management? Okay.
One, two, couple.
I believe two. We'll separate those and make sure you get those.
Well, I'll get them all. I just wanted to make sure that...
There were several, and we'll have that package too.
All right.
Yes, there was.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, the last thing I'd like to say is I want to thank you for this program, and it's really something that all of us can do, and that is we do it in many different capacities, and that is embracing our fellow veterans and loved ones when they come home, and it's a huge challenge. We all have to do it. I adopted a couple of them when they come home, and so we all do that, and very important. So I want to thank you. And so to those individuals that we also recognize whereby the certain concerns that aren't readily identified come up later, we pick that up through our fellowship. And we can then circulate them back into the system. So congratulations, Commander. Wonderful. This will be a wonderful program.
Thank you.
With that, I want to thank you for your testimony, and I appreciate you being here. We'll continue our vigilance. All members have 5 legislative days to submit any statements for the record. The hearing is now adjourned.